21st, 2013 session of the House Interim Committee on Ag and Natural Resources. We are convened. This afternoon, I'm going to open an informational hearing, and we have several topics before us this afternoon. Bee health and pesticide use, Aggie Bonds, coastal multi-species conservation management plan, the boat check law, and a return favorite, pinnipeds. So with that, all of you know that we will have a very busy agenda this afternoon, and we will, my job to keep us all on track and on time here. And I, the chair, will appreciate everyone helping us do that. With that, I'm going to call up first Katie Koba and Dale Mitchell. And Paul Jepson, too, please. We're going to be discussing bee health and pesticide use.
Mr. Chair, Dale is not here today, so if you wanted to call up another person,
that would
up to
be
you.
Okay, if you have anyone else. How about Scott Black?
I'm going to hand these to you. These are reports for the committee and staff.
Thank you very much. I want to thank Representative Reardon for championing this issue and being the person who has really motivated our committee to investigate this issue. And I want to thank each of you for being here today. Welcome, good afternoon, and please decide among yourselves how you will proceed.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and go.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. As you mentioned, you have a full agenda. You also have a very full panel, and so I'm going to go through a lot of information in a hurry, but certainly if you have questions, I'll do my best to answer those.
Thank you.
And for the topic this afternoon, I was going to focus specifically on the incidences that we had this summer and what the Department of Agriculture has been doing following those incidences and the actions, some proposed actions that we're going to be taking as a result of our investigation so far. So I think you all are aware that in June we had a very significant bee die-off incident in Wilsonville that the department responded to at that point in time, along with a lot of partners. And then subsequent to that, we became aware of fairly, as well, significant bee die-off from an incident in Hillsboro. And then later that summer, a couple of other incidences came to our attention. We immediately, with the Wilsonville event, became involved. And I'm going to let some others talk about work that was done at that point in time. But as is falls under the purview of the Department of Agriculture, we instigated an investigation, a pesticide investigation related to that incident. Because of the significance of the number of bees that died, we also, within a few weeks, instituted a temporary emergency rule that prohibited the use of the product that had been sprayed on the trees in Wilsonville, dinotefuran, to allow us to continue our investigation, determine just what happened in that incident, and prevent the potential from something related to that happening during the course of our investigation. So that rule went into effect on June 27th and will expire on December 24th. Our investigation is ongoing. We expect it to be complete in mid-December. But as I indicated, we've already taken a number of actions related to what we do know about that incident. And first of all, I want to stress that this is, from a regulatory standpoint, certainly the Department of Agriculture at the state level has a very prominent regulatory role related to pesticides. But we have a very strong partner in EPA at the federal level, and EPA really is the expertise in terms of analysis for pesticide products and makes the ultimate decision about products that are allowed to be registered and used in the United States. So we work very closely with EPA, and we have been sharing information with with them, and they've been a very strong partner with us as we've moved forward. But they really do have the scientific expertise that we rely on some of the issues that we're dealing with here. I think in terms of actions that have taken, I want to shift to that. First of all, EPA has been obviously concerned about the impacts of pesticide use on pollinators. We've had a lot of news about colony collapse disorder and concerns about bee health throughout the United States. Pesticides are just one of many issues that are probably contributing to the issues that we're facing with pollinators. But EPA has been looking at pesticide impacts on bees, and they actually made some label changes this summer that go into effect immediately, and some label restrictions that are related to the products that were used in Wilsonville and at the other incidences in Oregon. EPA has come out with new label requirements that are much clearer in terms of products that have the potential to be harmful to bees, and their label is much, as I said, much clearer and easier to understand now in terms of when you're using these products, how you use them, and when you should not use them. In addition, EPA has put some prohibition in place on a list of neonicotinoids in terms of foliar application when bees are nearby or when flowers are in bloom, again, to prevent incidences from occurring like we saw this summer, but broader than just our event. Those EPA changes came out this summer as well. At the state level, we have taken a number of actions related more specifically to this event. And first of all, under the category of education and outreach, two target audiences here. First of all, the general public, because dinutefuran, which was the product in the Wilsonville incident, and then imidacloprid in our two other incidences, are a subset of the neonics, and we believe there needs to be better outreach and education for both general public use as well as for licensed applicators. We have developed new brochures that will work with a whole host of partners in terms of getting that information out. Certainly, master gardeners are a key link for us in reaching the general public, and we will be reaching out to retailers to see about those that would be interested in including this kind of educational material in retail store shelves. Secondly, for our licensed applicators, we are beefing up the requirements in terms of both education and testing questions on the tests that we give to applicators before they can become licensed. And towards the end of my presentation, I'm going to actually hand out for you so that you have in hand a new publication that was developed by OSU that really is better information about how to properly use pesticides so that they minimize the impact on pollinators. The third step that we have taken is we are proposing a state restriction on the two products that I mentioned, dinutefuran and imidacloprid, that will go into effect in 2014. And so for those products that are sold, registered and sold in the state of Oregon, there is additional label restrictions. Those products cannot be applied to species, tilia species, of which a linden tree is a tilia species. In my tenure in the Department of Agriculture, we have only done additional state restrictions on pesticides one other time. So this is a fairly aggressive approach by the department, one that we use very carefully and cautiously, and we are now requiring that products that have either dinutefuran or imidacloprid cannot be applied to linden trees in the state of Oregon in the future. And then finally, we have sent a letter to EPA asking them to consider adopting these same restrictions at a national level and asking them to do more research into kind of the systemic nature in particular of these products and how long they are persistent in foliage that would be attractive to bees, and relook at whether there needs to be additional restrictions in place at the federal level. So those are the host of actions that the department has taken. As I said, our investigation is not complete and probably will not be complete until the middle of December. Finally, I just wanted to mention that, in addition, the department a couple of years ago provided a specialty crop block grant to do survey of pollinators in the state of Oregon. Those surveys are underway, and Paul may be speaking to that in his remarks. And I guess if there is good news in all of this, our initial survey results are showing that we do have a very healthy population and a diverse population of pollinators in the state of Oregon. That's critical for all of us. Certainly, I would say the general public has a love of bees. I would share that love. But for us as well in the agriculture industry, pollinators are very critical to the health of many of our crops. And so the good news is we do have a healthy pollinator population, and we want to keep it that way. So with that, I'll pause. I can certainly answer any questions, or if you want to go on to the rest of the panelists.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
And we're going to go ahead and hand out this document that I had mentioned so
that
you can see it. Very good.
That'll be very helpful. I think what we'll do is we'll proceed with a panel and then ask questions of all three of you.
Who's next?
Hello. Good afternoon. My name is Paul Jepson. I'm State IPM Coordinator. I direct the Integrated Plant Protection Center at OSU, and I'm a professor in the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology. I distributed some notes for you to review, and I was going to briefly capture these today because pesticides, bees, and neonicotinoids in particular have raised concern internationally, and I just wanted to illustrate the capacities we have and the way that we're currently responding, not meaning to say we've got every base covered, but to at least inform you about how OSU's and ODA are working together to meet this challenge. I first of all wanted to start by acknowledging ODA's diligent work and the steps they've taken. And that was based on scientifically based risk assessment and their view on protecting pollinators in Oregon. And so we very much commend that at Oregon State, but also feel it complements the work we do in research and extension. And when the three of us work together in all those three branches of, if you like, our response enabled, we can really work very effectively. So first of all, in your notes you'll see I've summarized three aspects of background that are meant to capture our capacities. First of all, as Director Koba said, there's a fantastic honeybee lab run by Ramesh Sagali at OSU, and they've conducted health studies, and as you know, pollinators internationally and Oregon as well are subject to a whole variety of challenges at the moment, many challenges that seem to kind of interact with each other. There's diseases, there's parasites, there's migratory pollination services which may pose threats to bees, there's the quality of the resource bees are provided with, there's the ways in which bees have traditionally been kept, what they're fed, how their immune systems respond to that. There's a whole variety of features of bee maintenance and biology that have been challenged by the modern world, not just agriculture. Pesticides are part of the picture, but they're just one part of it, and needing to understand that huge challenge is something that many hundreds of scientists are currently grappling with, not just in this country, but around the world. As a product of this, as the director mentioned, the OSU is conducting the Bee Health Survey, and of course it does find evidence of some challenges to bees, but they're not overwhelming in Oregon at present, and being alert to that and being able to monitor that in the long term is very important. As a product of our concern, though, about pesticide risks, Ramesh, Dr. Sagali, and colleagues have produced a new extension document, the title How to Reduce Pesticide Poisoning from Bees in the Pacific Northwest, which has been shared with you. I go on to mention here the fact that in the state IPM program, we gain access to thousands of farmers a year, and we've got an incredible record, really, in reducing pesticide risks through targeted, well-constructed education programs. Bee health and pesticides now are going to be a very significant part of that, and we'll be partnering with ODA as effectively as we can to make sure that that farmers get greater access to this information, the information that they need. And finally, with regard to myself, I'm probably the only person in the room to have actually diagnosed a major pesticide and bee health problem in the Europe in the 1990s. My lab conducted the research that was needed on the physiological impact of a combination of certain pesticides on bees. At the time, there were calls made for the banning of both of those classes of pesticide, which would have challenged crop production immensely. What occurred was a very refined and targeted regulatory response, such as we've seen here, that eliminated the problem. And how did we know that this was eliminated? Well, we have mandatory reporting of beehive losses in Europe, which I don't believe is part of the system here at the moment, and so you could track the decline followed by the recovery as a result of a targeted intervention. And so I think there's plenty of evidence that education, helping farmers gain the skills to manage risks, combined with targeted regulation is a great approach to take. And to be honest, in Oregon, I think we lead the world in that kind of interaction between our different agencies, largely brought about by the fact we're so resource limited quite often that we just have to work together, but it's yielded this kind of marvelous result. Having said that, OSU is responding to increased concerns about bees and pesticides. I've just summarized a few of these things here, but for the benefit of the people assembled, we've planned some education events for some thousands of farmers to take place winter 2014 that will provide them with new information. Myself and my group have put together a risk assessment tool, an online tool, where a farmer can enter an application rate for a pesticide and gain access to the world database that we've put together on pesticide risk to bees. And so that will be available to farmers from the winter of this year, and it's been field tested in Europe. I was invited by the European Union to go to Poland to test this a few weeks ago, and it's been proven to be very effective, and it will go out into Oregon once the peer review is completed. We'll have an online pollinator risk assessment and management course to be delivered in early 2014. And a residential course in September next year for experts in the field to gather together to really share their experiences. So we're not kind of holding back, we're responding, and obviously we may feel the need to respond further. I think the message from this is that we're quite adaptive in our response. A major problem arises, whether it be threats to salmonidae from pesticides or threats to bees, and working with ODA, I think we can work very, very effectively together. With regard to neonicotinoids, I just wanted to say a few words, if that's okay. Because this is a class of chemistry, it's a diverse class of chemistry. Speaking of a diverse range of chemicals as if they all have the same properties is kind of against my principles, really, because they don't all have the same properties. They're not all equally challenging and threatening, despite what you may hear. They were introduced in the 1990s in response to concerns about pesticide resistance, human health and wildlife impacts with the older classes of chemistry, and we really needed something different in that era. There is concern now that, looking back on the process that led to them being registered, certain red flags may have been ignored at the time. So whereas now I believe we've got a really amazingly effective pesticide regulatory process in the USA, and many of the decisions made with regard to neonicotinoids at the time seemed to be wise and progressive, in hindsight we are responding to some of those remaining challenges that were there at the time now. They've become the most widely used insecticides in the world. There's no doubt about that. We have hundreds of uses for them registered in Oregon for commercial application in agriculture and horticulture, as well as for homeowners. And they've got certain properties like being systemic. They pass up through the tissues of plants, and they're present in foliage and pollen and nectar, and naturally, therefore, they're available to bees, and that raises some concern. There is, however, very wide variation between the toxicity of the different neonicotinoid compounds to bees. So I would advise the committee in its deliberations not to lump them all together into one group of compounds. That wouldn't be scientifically justified. There are other wildlife risks. They're highly toxic to birds, and that is a concern. And one of the issues here is that we test certain bird species for regulatory approval in the United States, but neonicotinoids seem to pose risk to certain birds and not others, so we may not have got that quite right. And the same issue seems to apply to aquatic life. So we understand there are problems, and we believe that, again, a targeted regulatory and education approach, backed up by all the reviews that have been carried out by EPA, is a kind of good way forward. There's certainly evidence for risk to pollinators. There's a very large literature of several hundred publications now, which are under constant review. I've been invited by the European Union to Italy next week to the headquarters of the European Food Standards Authority to talk about many of these issues. And certainly, many of the laboratory studies that one can review, which you might be shared with you, are at sometimes up to 10,000 times the rate at which bees might be exposed to pesticides in the real world. So to be honest with you, we can't come up with a definitive scientific adjudication yet. There's what we call uncertainty. And where uncertainty exists, then some action has to be taken, which I believe you're hearing evidence of today. There is concern, however, I must add, about what we call a domino effect, where we suddenly paint one particular a whole class of chemistry as being incompatible with pollination services, and then that gets kind of passed on to other classes of chemistry, and it leads to an unnecessary debate which draws our attention away from the need also to support our agriculture and horticulture industries in Oregon. So finally then, highlight notes for the committee to consider at the end. I think we've got a unique record of merging our talents in regulation, education and extension. We're already responding, but I know we can do more. And so having this public process going on is really welcomed by all of us in the room, I believe, as well as the audience here and people beyond. There's many effective regulatory, educational and research options for Oregon, some of which I list here, some of which we're well aware of and will need to be implementing. We do work through the applicator licensing process in support of ODA's mandate, and we have access to thousands of applicators, and within months they can get access to new information and advice and recommendations, and we've got a history of demonstrating that results in reduced risk in the field. I'm not suggesting we should all be completely reassured by that, but we do have a pathway for progress that we've demonstrated in Oregon works very well, and this is recognized around the world. So celebrate that capacity, but make sure it gets focused on where it needs to be in Oregon. And my final note was, again, to remind you that the Honeybee Lab and Sir Jaya Rao's program in Crop and Soil Sciences at OSU and others work in cooperation with ODA and other partners in Oregon and internationally are working on the many, many different challenges to bees. And although this is certainly one that we take seriously, bees and the pesticide exposure, it's not as if it's the only threat that's out there. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I will move this over here and make sure that you can hear me and that I can hit some slides. I've got a few slides here to go with my talk today. First, I want to say thank you for having me here. My name is Scott Hoffman Black, and I'm the Executive Director of the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. We're an international group that works with scientists across the world for the betterment of all sorts of invertebrate animals, from honeybees to butterflies, from freshwater mussels to beetles. And I want to thank ODA especially, as well as OSU, but ODA really had a rapid response to this bumblebee kill this summer. I was amazingly gratified at how quickly they responded. We worked with so many entities, including the city of Wilsonville, to wrap those trees so that more bumblebees would not die. But of course, we don't want to be in those situations again, and that's, I think, why ODA is taking some steps that I think are very, very appropriate. So the title of my talk today is Are Neonicotinoids Killing Bees? The Research Behind the Claims. And much of my talk is based on two really comprehensive reports by the Xerces Society. Copies of these comprehensive reports and the two-page summaries are provided to the committee, and anybody here can also download these reports from our website to freely see how we have summarized all of this multiple data that we're talking about today. Just briefly, pollinators, in addition to their central role in maintaining healthy ecosystems, are vital for agriculture. Billions of dollars worth of crops are pollinated in the United States, over $600 million in crops in Oregon. And I know that we're working with ODA on some aspects of the specialty crops work, and we do see a robust population of honeybees and other bees, but there are issues. Annual losses, USDA has shown, are between 30% and 40% for honeybee keepers nationwide. And it's not just honeybees, it's our native bees as well. In a new analysis that we're, which is in publication, over half of the bumblebees in the United States are in some level of decline. These are all Oregon species that are in decline. One of them may be extinct. But I do want to point out that this isn't due to pesticides alone. There are multiple issues going on here that affect bees and other pollinators. Habitat loss is, of course, an issue. Diseases, both with honeybees and potentially with bumblebees, are an issue. And, of course, pesticide use. And the one class of insecticides that keeps coming up over and over in conversations is neonicotinoids. So that's why I wanted to focus on that. Neonicotinoid insecticides, three different of these pesticides have been banned or have very limited restrictions on use in Europe for the next 2 years. In the United States, there's continued use. Their continued use has been controversial because of a possible link to honeybee die-offs especially. But what does the science tell us about these chemicals? Well, I totally agree that the chemistries of these chemicals are different, and but they do have some similarities across what I call the big four neonicotinoids. These are the four that are most used, and they're also the four that generally are the most toxic. This is imidacloprid, clothianidin, dinotefuran, and thiamethoxam. The four most widely used neonicotinoids are all highly toxic to honeybees and to bumblebees. And some of the breakdown products are just as toxic. Even if bees aren't killed outright, sublethal levels of neonicotinoids can damage their ability to fly, navigate, and to learn new tasks, which can impair their foraging ability. There's also emerging evidence that neonicotinoids, these specific products, affect the honeybee queen's ability to lay eggs, at least certain products, certain neonicotinoids. All of these issues impact hive health. Bumblebees exposed to imidacloprid at levels found in crops. That's the other thing is, yes, there are lots of lab studies that use way too much and you see catastrophic die-offs. But bumblebees found in exposed to field level had 85% fewer queens and had significantly reduced colony growth rates. Loss of queens will decrease, of course, future bumblebee populations. Also, the impact goes beyond pollinators. Our newest report shows many studies that show that these systemic insecticides can also have a negative impact on natural enemies such as lady beetles. So we know when pollinators are exposed to these chemicals that there can be a negative impact. But the real issue is, are they being exposed in the environment? I believe the answer is yes, and here's why. As Paul pointed out, they have a systemic mode of action. This means they can translocate to every part of the plant, including nectar and pollen. And yes, nectar and pollen, there will be less of these substances in them, but studies do show that they can reach lethal and sublethal levels at field realistic levels. Neonicotinoids are also really persistent. They can last in soil for months or years after a single application. And untreated plants may actually absorb the chemical residues from the plants from the previous year. This has been shown to happen. Measurable amounts of residues were found in woody plants up to 6 years after a single application. So they're toxic, they're long-lived. These products are also used widely around our homes. Products approved for home and garden use may be applied at significantly higher rates, up to 32 times higher than those in agricultural crops. And as Paul said, these are now the most widely used class of chemicals in the world. They are one of the most widely used class of chemicals in the country. Again, we can't lump them all, but we're using a lot of these chemicals. The USGS U.S. Geological Survey routinely finds these chemicals in stream samples across the U.S. You can see these four slides. Keep your eye on Oregon there. This is imidacloprid in 1994 when it was first registered and introduced for use. This is 1999. This is 2004. And this is 2009. We don't have newer records than that. But we're using a lot of these chemicals, and this is just only one. This is just imidacloprid. So the toxic nature of these products, the mode of action that allows these products to build up in pollen and nectar, and the fact that they are so long-lived in the environment and that they are used across such a large geographic area and in such large quantities leads many of us to the conclusion that the widespread use of neonicotinoid insecticides are indeed a real threat to bees. So what can be done? Well, the Xerces Society is supporting the Saving America's Pollinators Act, which was sponsored by Congressman Blumenauer. At our request, neonicotinoids were separated out in this act. We don't call for removing all neonicotinoids from the market. All we want to do is remove the four main, most toxic, and most widely used neonicotinoids from specific uses where they could impact pollinators and other beneficial insects until the EPA determines they're safe. You know, as a scientist, I have to say it seems that the whole system of pesticide registration is flawed, and this is one place where I slightly disagree with Paul on, and I think we're moving in the right direction, but we haven't gotten there yet. We should not be approving chemicals and then study to see whether they're safe. We need to study the chemicals to determine how specific uses impact non-target organisms and humans, of course, before they reach the marketplace and are spread widely throughout the environment. So how can Oregon help? Well, the state could consider a similar timeout for neonicotinoids for some of these products. Maybe the four neonicotinoids we mentioned in the Saving America's Pollinators Act, or we're happy to work with the committee, with Paul, on talking about what are the worst actors. The Xerces Society also believes that the state should require better label language than what EPA has laid out. From what we can tell, EPA's label language is better, but I'm not sure it's going to be really clear for the consumer especially. Right now, many products bought, almost all of the products bought in a hardware store, have no warning label on them that they could harm bees. None. You can't find it online either. And it seems that consumers tending their roses and rhododendrons have the right to know that these are harming their bees. It's kind of a right to know. Also, people are smart. They might not use as much or in certain places if they actually have the facts. So EPA has come part of the way. I'm really happy ODA is engaged, and I want to make sure that these labels are really good. The state could go beyond federal labels to end prophylactic use or cosmetic use. And the state could also require greater restrictions on how state government entities use neonicotinoids. And then last, I want you to support these people. They're the front line in educating people to on these chemicals, and that is really, really important. So state-funded outreach and education is vital. It could be through Oregon DEQ's Pesticide Stewardship Partnership Program or University Extension. It could be through ODA. And then the state should explore how the new IPM law could help. Paul, you're the head of that, and maybe the coordinating committee could take up the issue of to help state agencies understand and learn how to reduce these pesticides. So I believe the state can be a real positive actor in this. I want to thank, again, ODA and OSU for the actions they've taken, and I hope that we can take some more actions for the betterment of bees and all of the animals that need it. Thank you.
Thank you all very, very much. Questions for our panel members? I have a couple of questions myself. With respect to the die-off of bees that occurred over the summer here in Oregon, do your investigations suggest that we have a problem with the manner in which we either apply and or regulate pesticides in this state? Or were those incidences suggestive of mistakes made on an individualized basis when the application was made? Where does the problem lie? Because, quite frankly, I think getting to the bottom of this is the crux of where do we go in terms of creating public policy.
Mr. Chair, again, as I'd indicated, our investigation, unfortunately, is not yet complete.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't jump to speculating what the outcome of that investigation is, but I can say that the steps that we have taken and I outlined for you are because of things that we saw outside of just the pure investigation itself that led us to believe, A, we need clearer labels, which EPA has indeed moved forward with now. Secondly, we are concerned in particular with the two products, not products, dinotefuran and imidacloprid, that were applied to linden trees, and the combination of a linden tree, which has some natural toxicity along with these two products. Those were the constants in the incidences that we had this summer. So that's why we move forward in terms of a label restriction for applications specifically to linden trees. So those are things that we've learned through the course of the investigation and the steps that we're taking now.
And is that ban, that's a temporary ban?
The announcement that we've made is permanent, and we'll be requiring
permanent
registrants
ban.
To put that on their label if they're going to register products in the state of Oregon.
And are those neonicotinoids?
Those are two, I don't know the right title, subclasses? Two types of neonics.
They're two neonicotinoid pesticides, yes.
Okay, thank you.
And just to clarify, they're not. The ban is 6 months, but you're going to require more restrictions on the products once the ban is lifted. Is that correct?
The emergency temporary rule expires December 24th. What we have now sent to registrants for, if you're going to register a product for use in the state of Oregon, you have to put on the label from here on out that you cannot apply these products to linden trees.
That's a permanent ban on linden trees.
Okay. And am I correct in assuming that there would be alternatives to these two types of pesticides that have now been permanently banned in Oregon so that our agricultural community that is relying on pesticides has some other avenue to control whatever it is that they're attempting to control?
So I want to clarify that we're not banning the use of those products completely.
Okay.
We're just saying you cannot apply those two neonicotinoids to linden trees.
Or the broader class of tilia?
Or the broader class of tilia, which basically is a linden tree, a basswood tree, and some
Thank
other
you.
Kinds of things.
Thank you for that clarification.
And whether there are alternatives to that, I'd probably look to Dr. Jepson or others, since I'm not an entomologist by training.
There will be alternatives. Some of them will pose potentially higher risk to bees, some of them less so, but they'll be registered for that use. And when a use is eliminated, that sometimes prompts registrants to seek new labels, and so other chemistries appear. But as some of my colleagues have said in other fora, placing trees that are so susceptible to insects that deposit honeydew on cars parked under them and on furniture in the first place is something that we need to take a broader look at, because simply having a chemical that's available to solve a particular problem, when perhaps we had options about whether or not that problem should arise in the first place, that's where society's interest more broadly lies, I believe.
You anticipated my next question, so thank you very much. Mr. Black, if we were to, in essence, ban the foremost hazardous neonicotinoids, do you have any sense of what impact that may have on Oregon agriculture?
Yes, and again, I want to state that We are not asking, and the bill actually doesn't ask for a ban. The goal is to look at where, like with tilia, with certain crops, we have the highest potential impact to bees, and then to remove them until EPA can show where these products are safe to use. So rather than having them out there where they may not be safe, it's pulling them until EPA can show that they're safe. Right now, they have until 2017 to do the registration and re-registration on these products, and many of us believe that they could go much quicker, especially if they thought that these chemicals were not going to be able to be used on certain crops. Now, if we wanted to do that, we work with agricultural producers across the country, and so we do understand that this could be a major issue, and so we would want to work to look at what all those other options are. And generally, we want to look at where we can use less of these products anyway. What we're finding in some systems is that these products don't conform very well in some instances. Again, I want to really go with what Paul said, that these chemicals are different. Each one is different. But with IPM, when you can apply them once a year and they're in a product, and we're all most concerned although we're concerned with agriculture and we think we should be looking at that, but also the home use is really a major issue that we want to get at with this issue. Because homeowners do not have the opportunity to understand, to go through a class by Paul Jepson. They're not pesticide applicants, and yet they can apply much, much more of this chemical than anybody could apply to any crop. So we see this as a real area of common ground that we hope we could work with you and with Paul and with ODA on.
I just had a small point to add, if I may. There would undoubtedly be consequences of a ban in commercial agriculture and horticulture. We can't really anticipate what those would be. The ones that I've become aware of are where there's an incident to do with pesticide impacts in streams, perhaps, or with resistance build-up, or cost, or eliminating an overseas marketplace because we've taken an action which suddenly results in an unforeseen consequence. So all of these things do need to be thought through. I would also say that, just to reiterate a point I made in my testimony, that we've got a great record in Oregon that when we work with commercial applicators and professional audiences to address a specific risk, we can eliminate that risk. And I do differentiate the different uses, as Scott hinted at here, that and I think protecting our industry and recognizing how responsible our professionals are in Oregon, but also knowing that they didn't know these issues were going to arise, and that we're responding as energetically as we can, that I would say suggests to me that it would be appropriate to have some caution and just see how it goes with the approach that we're already bringing to bear here. So I just wanted to make that clear. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think one additional question that I would have. I'm left to wonder whether it is necessary or in the best interest of general ecological health to arm me as a private citizen with my home applicator with neonicotinoids. Is it necessary? Is it I do not intend a pun here, but is it overkill?
Well, I believe that in many cases for cosmetic use, like this was used on linden trees in Target for honeydew for aphids, that we should really be educating the public that they don't need to use these products. I mean, there are times when if you have an invasive species moved in, we work across the country, and right now we're responding to emerald ash borer in Boulder County. There's a big, big push to use neonicotinoids there because it will solve that invasive species problem, and we're looking at whether that is the best option. We are open to looking at options, but I think you're right that armed without proper information, especially the homeowner is not often equipped to use any of these products. And that's where I really hope we go beyond what EPA is trying to do, to truly label these in such an easy way that people can understand that they're actually potentially causing problems.
Mr. Chair, I might just add for the committee's understanding, home use of these products is not just to plants that flower.
Yes.
So probably the majority of products that have dinotefuran in them are actually spot flea treatments that you're putting on dogs and cats.
Yeah.
So I think you need to be cautious in understanding the variety of products that are out there, what their use is, and where there is potential or not for.
Which is why we're sensitive. The bill does not exclude dog and cat uses or termite uses or many, many other uses that the Blumenauer bill does not exclude those uses. We were very careful about that.
Thank you very, very much for those clarifications. Are there any additional questions or comments for our panel? Representative Clem.
I just want to make one comment. Oh, that last, is that in sleep mode? Can you wiggle your little...
What's that?
Oh. That last one.
Any questions?
That one.
Yes.
I just, want to thank you for recognizing these efforts. We just, with industry support, increased the funding, partially at their expense, partially at the state's expense, for new pesticide stewardship partnership agreements. And I think, having our IPM committee study these things, because I can tell you from somebody who's part of a family and part of a company who spends a lot of money on sprays, it's the last thing I really want to do, to be honest, is spend $60,000 a year on sprays. And I don't want to kill the bees either, because we're fruit orchardists. That's how we make our money. Trying to find ways, to work with scientists and engage in these collaborative efforts to figure out how to spend less money better for the environment, better for the bees, is something that's positive, and I think Oregon's done a lot, even recently, real recently, in the last 6 or 7 months to step that up.
Yes.
So thank you for flagging it, though, as a good approach.
Yes, and that's what we do across the country, is try to educate people how they can grow crops by using less pesticides. Or still using less, not
yeah, buying. When appropriate, that's what you use. Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you.
Representative Rubin?
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you so much for all of your testimony, and it's wonderful to know that we have people with your dedication to protecting both the agricultural, the crops, and the bees, making sure we still have viable business and protect our environment. Could you clarify for me the education and training that is provided to, and perhaps testing, that is provided to, say, the commercial applicators versus, and I think I know the answer to the second one, which is the home user. So,
firstly, the state requires applicators in agriculture to have a license and to receive training and to pass an exam. And I learned today from ODA that they'll be requiring study of the extension document you've been given a copy of, and questions will be asked about that to ensure that everybody in the commercial world, and many public applicators too, I imagine, will have access to that. And I believe that's a rather progressive step, to be honest with you, that could have a very beneficial result, because people are simply not aware of some of these issues until the attention's brought to them. We have a much less intimate, direct, and complete access to the public and the people that walk into a supermarket and buy products off the shelf. We have an extraordinary group of Master Gardener volunteers in the state. We've got extension offices, although diminishing in number, distributed throughout the state that many people gain access to, but that's a fraction of the people that buy products off the shelf. I do understand some supermarkets of their own volition have put some notices on the shelves regarding neonicotinoids, and I don't know about the quality of those, but I think that's flagging that up, that's rather good. And we could take steps to require, I guess, further education to take place. But to be honest with you, we're stretched incredibly thin in many ways already to gain access to the audiences we do have access to. So I think we're looking at qualitatively quite a big difference. And I think it's really extraordinary that, we can get access to really many thousands of people a year through the network that we work with in the commercial applicator world. And their responses are evidenced by the fact that DEQ, for example, finds a diminution of pesticide concentrations in surface waters when we target particular chemistries and uses. So we know that that works. And we don't really have that evidence chain from the homeowner access. So I know that my colleagues in the Master Gardener program will be devoting a lot of effort to this, and we'll have some training and education programs at OSU. And there are other organizations, of course, that provide support efforts. But when you've got the chemical on the shelf and it's being advertised in the way it is, and your deck furniture doesn't look as pretty as it did a few weeks before, I personally, as a scientist, do have a concern about the safe and effective use of products under those circumstances.
And just, I think an important point is USGS routinely, when they're looking at water quality samples for pesticides, and I don't know of any in Oregon, but if you look at what they've done in Seattle, if you look at what they've done back east, routinely find more pesticides in surface waters in and around urban and suburban areas than they do in agricultural areas. So there are more of these things being used on in a concentrated level around the homeowners, both by homeowners and by some professionals that do lawn care and other things. But we should realize that as well. It's not a smaller part. There's a lot of this being used. I don't think that takes away with the work we want to do with producers to make sure that that bees are safe in agricultural areas, but I just wanted to make sure we pointed that out.
Thank you. It's important.
More clarification. Thank you. The people that are licensed, they're the commercial applicators, and they have to have a license, so that's one class of people. Where do they work, and are there other farmers out there that may go to the local farm store and buy stuff and use it that don't have a license?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, private applicators also receive training and licensing through us. And I would make the probably highly uneducated statement, but I'll make it anyway, that my guess is a farmer is maybe more knowledgeable than your general urban dweller in terms of using and properly taking care of pesticides. But yes, farmers must have a private applicator license to apply restricted use pesticides on the shelf. General use pesticides, you don't need that training, but they get the training on the other side, so they're probably well aware of how to handle these kinds of products.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? Panel members, I want to thank you very, very much for the information that you've provided us. It's very important. I want to recognize the state's response. Thank you very, very much for that. And I want to thank each of you individually, as well as the organizations that you represent, for the responsible manner in which you've addressed this problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call forward, please, Carson Lord and Scott Dahlman.
May I have a question?
I didn't see it raises
here. Did you have a question?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. If I may, before I start, I could address your question a little bit further. I am a licensed private pesticide
applicator. Would you please identify yourself?
Of course. My name is Carson Lord. I own Tree Frog Nursery in Silverton, Oregon. I'm the past president of the Oregon Association of Nurseries, and I'm a licensed pesticide applicator. To answer your question, the state offers a few different levels of licenses for pesticide applicators. There's a private pesticide applicator level, there's a commercial level, and then there's also a consultant level. And all of them require a progressively more difficult testing, and then a larger number of hours. The licenses are good for 5 years each, and within those 5 years, to maintain your license, you need to attend a certain number of classes and receive credits to maintain those licenses. As Katie Koba mentioned, for general use pesticides, they are not required. most people in agriculture choose to get the license to be able to use some of the restricted use pesticides as they're needed, as well as the education that comes along with it. But like I said, the commercial applicators, people that would be applying anything in public places, need a further license. And my license is a private pesticide applicator. I would not be allowed to apply pesticides in any public places or on my neighbor's property or anything like that.
Okay.
My intent today is not to be pro-pesticides or anti-bee, because I'm neither. I'm a big fan of almonds, blueberries, and most of the other crops that need pollination. And as a nurseryman, I'm keenly aware of our need for effective insecticides. What I would like to see is rational decisions based on science, not political posturing and knee-jerk reaction. Insecticides can kill bees. That isn't news. Chemical manufacturers go through a rigorous and incredibly expensive process before they can ever bring a pesticide to market. Neonicotinoid class insecticides are very effective when used properly, and in most instances offer a safer alternative for the workers who apply them and the people who park their cars under the trees where they are applied. In my opinion, a pesticide applicator broke the law last summer and incorrectly applied a pesticide named Safari. His misuse caused the death of thousands of bees. Pesticides are used every day all around us. Nearly every piece of produce, nut, and grain in our grocery store has been sprayed for pests. Pesticides are used in our landscapes, our parks, our homes, and throughout agriculture. We rely on insecticides to produce our food, protect our forests and landscapes, and protect our health and well-being from insect-borne diseases and discomfort. Applied correctly, pesticides are very safe. It is being suggested that dinotefuran, the active ingredient in Safari, or more broadly, the neonicotinoid class of insecticides, should be banned because of the risk posed to pollinators. The argument for this ban is not backed by science. There is no direct link demonstrated between neonicotinoids and colony collapse disorder. To be sure, every insecticide comes with a risk, and we have strong laws and regulations to mitigate these risks. When scientists compare toxicity of different substances, they use the term LD50. LD50 is the medium lethal dose or amount of a given substance that will kill 50% of a mammalian population. The results are expressed as milligrams per kilogram of body weight. The higher the number, the less toxic the substance is to animals or humans. To give perspective, the LD50 of acetaminophen or Tylenol is 338. The LD50 of Safari is 2,804. The closest substance I could find at an LD50 of 3,000 is salt. If we extrapolate these numbers to a 150-pound human, 0.8 ounces of acetaminophen would be lethal to half the population, while it would take over 8 times that amount, 6.7 ounces of Safari, to have the same effect. As it is applied in solution, you would need to drink over 600 gallons of the prepared spray to reach this level. You may also hear that there are several other classes of insecticides to control problem insects. This is true. However, each comes with a trade-off. Organophosphates, for example, are much more toxic to humans. Pyrethroids pose a huge risk to fish and aquatic invertebrates. Simply put, the more choices we have, the better we're able to select the most effective and safest chemistry for the task at hand. I urge you to let science and reason be your guide. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Dahlman, and I'm here today on behalf of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We are a grassroots coalition made up of farmers, foresters, and other chemical users, and we all have an interest in this issue. I want to thank you for holding this hearing today. The issue of bee health is important to all Oregonians. This is a particularly difficult issue for my membership because as growers, you need pollinators to pollinate your crops, but you also need to have the pesticide tools available to be able to control the damaging pest as well. And we can all agree that nobody wants to see any more adverse incidents involving pesticides and bees. So why are we here today? Concerns around bees and pesticides have been around for decades, but two high-profile incidents in Oregon have kind of brought some increased scrutiny around. Unfortunately, the neonicotinoid class of pesticides has really become a focus in this conversation, although it is a much broader conversation. So in Wilsonville, I won't rehash the details too much, but as most of you know, 50,000-plus dead bees were found in the parking lot of a Target store there after an application of dinotefuran to linden trees. This incident was very visible and very shocking. I mean, you could see the pictures on the front of the newspaper, and it's something that took everybody back really quickly. So the public became justifiably outraged about what was going on. We think Department of Ag did a reasonable thing by stepping in and putting in some temporary restrictions during the time that they're doing the investigation so they could figure out exactly what was going on there. Now, while we don't know what the final results officially will be of the investigation, all signs are pointing now that there was probably a misapplication that took place there in that incident. There is no doubt that if neonicotinoids are used inappropriately, then they can be toxic to bees. Nobody will deny that. And OFS will always support that misapplications should be dealt with according to the law, and that the violators of the law should be held accountable for that. You need to read the label, and you need to follow the label. The other major incident we saw was the follow-up was the linden trees that were treated in Hillsboro, where over 200 linden trees were treated with dinotefuran again. This was a little different because the treatment was several months before some dead bees appeared underneath the tree. This was more in the hundreds of bees. But the remarkable part about this one is although 200 trees were treated, the bees were concentrated underneath one tree. This leads us to believe that there might have been something specifically going on with this tree. So what do these applications have in common? Well, both of these applications had the same active ingredient, dinotefuran. Both applications were to linden trees, which are of the Tilia species. Why is this so important? Well, it's because if linden trees are stressed, they can produce mannose to a level that can actually become toxic to bees, which is why we're seeing that these cases are a little more complicated, because you've got a natural toxin that these trees can produce, which can be toxic to bees on their own, aside from the use of any pesticide products. And so it muddies the waters a little bit, and you'll hear me say that a lot during this, because as we look at colony collapse disorder, bee declines, we're not finding any simple cut and dry answers. And so there's a lot of nuance within everything. So why are neonicotinoids important? Well, they've been used for more than 15 years, and they've been widely adopted, as you could see from the maps earlier, by growers and urban applicators because of their performance, because of their lower toxicity to mammals, including humans, and their relatively favorable environmental profile over the older products that they replaced. They are some of the most widely used and important tools for our growers controlling insects today. Their potential toxicity for bees, if used improperly, has shined a spotlight on this class of chemicals, but real-world testing of concentrations that we're finding out there in the field have not shown levels that would be of concern. The big reason for this is that the concentration of neonicotinoids, we talked about them being a systemic, in the bee-attractive parts of the plant, so in the flower, in the nectar, and the pollen, is significantly lower than what goes into the stems and the leaves. And so even when you're finding higher concentrations within other areas of the plants, the areas that the bees visit generally have lower concentrations. So when looking at all of this, obviously we want to look at how pesticides are regulated. So every pesticide that's used in Oregon has gone through both US EPA and the ODA registration process. At the federal level, pesticides are regulated under FIFRA, which is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. It's kind of a mouthful, so when you hear FIFRA, that's what it is. The initial and ongoing re-registration of these products is subject to substantial review process, and registered products have to meet a standard through the EPA process of having no unreasonable adverse effect on health or the environment, which means that these products met that standard. The pesticides that we're talking about here, the neonicotinoids have had testing done and submitted to EPA on honeybee acute contact toxicity, honeybee toxicity of residues on foliage, and field testing for pollinators. So there is testing that goes in before these things are released. So the big issue coming up, obviously, is surrounding bees and this idea of colony collapse disorder. So what is colony collapse disorder? So it's kind of the broad term that's being used to describe scenarios in which large numbers of bees within a colony do not survive. It's generally over overwintering, and oftentimes they don't even return to the hive. This is an issue of worldwide concern, and we're seeing it both in countries that use neonicotinoids and countries that do not. Research on colony collapse disorder has highlighted the complex interaction of factors that play a role in bee health, but has found no singular cause. While pesticides have been identified as a contributing factor, they have not been identified as the primary one. In 2006, after bee losses were beginning to be reported, they put together a national bee health committee to start looking at bee health issues so we could try to get ahead of what was going on. In cooperation with EPA and USDA, they released a comprehensive report in October of 2012. What the report concluded is that there was recognition that the varroa mite is the single most detrimental pest of honeybees and is closely associated with the overwintering colony collapse. It notes multiple diseases associated with colony collapse disorder, which are amplified by that varroa mite. It urges adoption of best management practices to enhance bee health, recognizes the need to significantly improve genetic diversity within US bee populations, recommends increased nutritional options to lessen the susceptibility to stressors, recommends continued research on pesticide impacts at field-relevant exposure levels, and calls for greater collaboration and information sharing among stakeholders to facilitate adoption of BMPs that are critical to improving bee health. That's a mouthful. That's a lot of information, but that should help shade when we're looking at this issue, that it is very complex and there's a lot of different things going on. So what is EPA doing to kind of deal with this issue that is raising up right now? They've been petitioned to ban neonicotinoids. There's been two petitions that have gone to them. In the response to a petition in 2012, EPA concluded that, and this is a quote, EPA is not aware of any data indicating that honeybee declines or the incidence of colony collapse disorder in the U.S. is correlated with the use of pesticides in general or with the use of neonicotinoids in particular. So while the scientific evidence points away from neonicotinoids being the primary concern in bee losses, it is clear, again, that misapplications can result in adverse effects. So the other thing the EPA is doing right now is they've implemented some new...
Yes. Excuse me to interrupt.
Yeah, no problem.
Excuse me, Representative.
I'm just hoping for a little bit of clarification. I thought earlier when Director Koba was up here, you asked about whether this was a misapplication or whether it was proper use that needed a policy change. Is it the case that, and maybe Director Koba could come up and answer this question, was it misapplication or was it was an actual problem that then actually forced the department to create a policy change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Unger, Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. Unfortunately, our investigation is not complete, so we're not ready yet to say if it was one or the other or a combination of both. We're looking at mid-December, and we'll have better information then.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director.
Okay, I'll try to wrap up here, and you've got more comments there, but again, it's a huge, complex issue, so I'm trying to bring a lot of things forward in the brief time that we've got here. So you've heard that EPA is instituting new label requirements. This is on four active ingredients. The big four, as they have been termed before, but clothianidin, dinotefuran, imidacloprid, and thiomethoxam. If you look in the back of the handout that I gave to you guys, that is from the EPA, and it shows you the new language. They're calling it the bee box that will appear on products containing these active ingredients. It brings more attention to the potential toxicity to bees and makes very clear the proper way to use those products. Those will be appearing in early 2014 and on all the new labels of these products. In addition to these new label requirements, EPA has been active in several other fronts in relation to the issue. I won't list them out. They're listed in the packet there. But overarchingly, they're working on more research, more coordination, and more education. So in conclusion, as you can see, the interaction of bees and pesticides is an issue that is being taken very seriously by growers, manufacturers, and regulators. The EPA is working hard to ensure that pesticide tools are used in an appropriate and scientifically sound manner, and we think that ODA has taken good steps moving forward, very targeted to address potential issues. Pesticides are just one part of the much bigger picture, and we're hopeful that work will also be done to address the other issues of bee health decline, because it is an important issue for our growers. OFS stands ready to assist in any outreach efforts to get out to the users. That's who our members are. Any information that might be helpful to make sure that everybody is educated on the potential problems and the proper use of these products. But lastly, we believe that the current science shows that properly used neonicotinoid pesticides pose no unreasonable risk to the environment, and we would be imposed to further restrictions without evidence that the proper use of these products is causing a problem. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions for you guys.
Thank you very much. Questions, Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair. So you would be opposed to using this as to having this these subset of pesticides be declared restricted use? And if so, why? Because it sounds like to me, if these pesticides are properly used, we all can live in harmony. And the industry who actually needs to use them to make sure that we can promote the agricultural industry in the state, they have the pesticide licenses. So why not just make them a restricted use pesticide so that we can make sure that the pesticide is being used properly?
Chair Witt, Representative Unger, I appreciate that question. You've got some bigger issues at hand. So one, if you remove them, you see that they're used quite a bit by homeowners. They're used quite a bit by homeowners because they're an effective product for them to use. And if you take that away, homeowners are going to be looking for something else to use. The other thing is, I think it needs to be really clear that not all growers have pesticide licenses. And so it would add another barrier to the ones who do not to be able to use those products.
Additional questions or comments? Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering if you mentioned bee loss due to mites. And I was wondering if you have any numbers to sort of back up those bees lost to mites versus those to the nicotinamides.
Yeah, I don't have those numbers top of my head, and quite frankly, I don't know if the numbers are delineated this way. I just, I will give you whatever information I can, but I do know that the varroa mite is a very, very serious concern, both because of the effect it has on bees and also the disease transmission through the varroa mites. And that has been identified as one of the biggest issues to be addressed on this, but as far as specific numbers, I don't have those off the top of my head.
Or studies? I mean, could you, like, get us the studies?
Yeah.
That'd be great.
I'd be happy to do that.
Great. Thank you. Anything further? Committee members? Representative Reardon?
I'm back to the same question. I apologize for that because okay. I just got confused. You just said that not all growers have a license. And I was feeling quite good that, you know, we had information going out and people were being trained and they're being tested and new information was coming out. Could you elaborate then about who does not have a license and why don't they, and what would it take maybe to license people?
So
they really need this.
I have no idea on the numbers. The sense is a majority of growers have them, as was mentioned, because they need to use different restricted use pesticides, and so they will go and get them. But there's not a requirement if they're only applying on their own land, and so there are growers that choose not to do that, to go through the process to get licensed.
Okay.
Representative, if I may, to clarify, as a nursery owner, if I'm just going to be using general use pesticides, I do not need to have a specific license. But if I would like to purchase restricted use pesticides, then I must have a license to be able to purchase those.
The question is, do we add this to some of these neonicotinoids to the restricted use category? And if we do, who would be tested?
Yes. Is that a question?
asking for clarification, I guess. I just want to make sure I understand. We could consider adding four, at least four of these chemicals to the restricted use list.
Sure. There are certainly other cases where specific insecticides have been moved from general use to restricted use.
And if we did that, then a larger number of the users of this material would be licensed, would require, have to be licensed. Mm-hmm.
Theoretically, 100%.
Okay. And is that, in your experience, is that a burden?
Pesticides, like a little old lady's garden would go.
In my experience, it was something I chose to do even before I needed to purchase a restricted use pesticide because I wanted the education.
As a representative of your industry, if you could just broaden beyond your experience a little bit, would it be a burden to have more people licensed to use this material?
In my opinion, for our industry, for some of the smaller growers, it could pose a burden that aren't currently licensed as private pesticide applicators. However, for the larger nurseries, I would venture a guess that the very vast majority of them do have people that are licensed.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yes. Representative Plum?
Yeah, I just thought I would give my colleague sort of practical, what I know about it. On our orchard, my mother-in-law's got a license. Our foreman has a license. Other people don't. I don't, because I don't spray. One sprays our foreman. His kid, who's our assistant foreman, he went and got a license. Yeah. My father-in-law, I think he let his go because the foreman did all the work. So sometimes within an organization, there's some people who spray, some who don't.
Sure.
And then if you're small enough and you don't want to deal with having to take all the classes, so you hire somebody. But if you've got enough money to hire somebody, you might hire somebody and not get the license yourself. But when you're growing something commercially, someone usually will have one on the place, or they'll hire a service to do it for them just automatically. I think the bigger issue is like the little lady in the garden club, and she's using something on her roses right now. Mm-hmm. She'll just probably buy whatever else now is on the shelf that somebody in her garden club said is good and will work. And what we don't know probably is what the effect of that something else is either at the moment. I don't know, but I'm just throwing some stuff out here.
Can I ask a question based on what Representative Clement was saying, which is, are there other alternatives that currently exist on the market that the little old lady from the garden club is going to go buy? Because I do think that's the most likely
scenario. My mother-in-law's in the Parkdale Garden Club. That is exactly how it works, by the way.
Yeah, no, it is. That will be what happens.
I would say yes, there's certainly other things that will kill aphids. It depends on what they're targeting. But with every one of those chemistries comes a trade-off. And I spoke to the safety of neonicotinoids to mammals, to humans, to your pets. And I spoke of a couple of them, organophosphates, which are used around homes. My wife, for example, hired a place that had Eco in the name of the pest control when we had very young children to control some infestation. And I was very curious after they were done. I got home and I looked at the receipt to see what they'd use. It was Dursban. Dursban is a restricted use pesticide. It's an organophosphate. It's one of the, in my opinion, the worst things that we use in horticulture, and that's what was applied around my home by this company that was billing themselves as this ecological pest control service. So when you take away something that's safe for, it depends on what you want to protect. You talk about the runoff. So if we switch to pyrethroids, then you're going to have more issues for aquatic invertebrates or fish. So picking your poison is an apt description of this.
And the issue is, those little lays aren't going to go hire a licensed applicator to continue doing their gardening. So they are going to work with whatever they heard or Home Depot looks good. No one's going to go out and hire a licensed applicator, I don't think, to take care of stuff they currently enjoy taking care of themselves, and that's part of their life. So if we think we're going to get more licensed applicators out of this, no, they'll just use something different. We just need to understand what something different is, I think.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I'd like to call up next, please, Alan Taransky and Harry Vanderpool. Good afternoon and welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Please identify yourselves before you testify.
us on seats?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm Harry Vanderpool, Oregon State Beekeepers Association, Vanderpool Farms in South Salem. Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives, for the time today. Vanderpool Farms runs a beekeeping operation based in the South Salem Hill locations for 23 years. We're involved with crop pollination and honey production. Here's a view from our back field. If you'll just kind of gaze on beyond the hives there, you'll see 125 acres of Christmas trees. This is a look, a view across our front field. You'll see another 125 acres of Christmas trees. Christmas trees require spray application of insecticides that are highly toxic to honeybees from time to time. And this could cause a conflict, but there is no conflict between our neighbors. And there won't be, because my neighbors and I, along with a growing number of farmers and beekeepers in Oregon, are adopting the philosophy that we are all working very hard and need to make a living at the same time. Therefore, we're working together. This requires understanding, a whole lot of communication by all parties. Over time, we've worked it all out. I will receive calls well in advance of spray applications. I thank them repeatedly. This gives me information about moving hives in and out between pollination sets. Here's a not-so-good story. Several years ago, a grower calls me for 20 hives that are needed to pollinate pumpkins. I return a week later to check the hives, and here's what greets me. Shovelfuls of dead bees around the hives. Now just look across the pumpkins out there and you'll see in the background 40 acres of snap beans. I call my grower and I ask him if he had sprayed the beans, and he tells me he'd sprayed them yesterday with malathion right after lunch. I gently explained to him that the off-label application not only wiped out the majority of honeybee foragers that he's paying for, but worse, has had a tragic impact on the many native pollinators that he is not paying for, but certainly need. He replied, "You know, I need to think more about things like that." This was a turning point when I realized that the commitment and the relationship that I enjoy with my neighbors needs to extend to everyone that I work with. Since this incident, the grower pays very close attention. But honestly, these type of incidents happen almost every single day to beekeepers across the state. I'm an officer in the Oregon State Beekeepers Association. We're on our cell phones all the time. One nice thing, we work alone, but we can wear a Bluetooth and we talk. And a big thing is every day during the growing season, we enter a field and there's pesticide kills here or there. In the example I just gave, and in the bumblebee kills at Wilsonville that were in the news earlier this year, at least we had a smoking gun. Most of the time, we do not. So our only response is to work on building the hives back up. If this happens too late in the fall, affected hives are likely to be lost, and our winter loss percentage will increase. And don't forget, as always, the loss of the native pollinators. Okay, here's a guy cleaning a spray rig. He did everything right in his application for minimal impact, but here he is on a 100-degree day creating puddles laced with insecticides. Bees are going to drink this water and die. Most bee kills are not the result of the chemical use, but rather the misuse, careless, and lackadaisical application or disposition. And even the best label gives very minimal information. Proper use of chemicals with pollinator protection in mind goes way beyond just reading the label. And if I may, Mr. Chair, I would like to answer your question that you asked to the first panel. And I'm positive that if you polled most Oregon commercial beekeepers, remember, we're moving our crops from crop to crop to crop all year long from February until August, they will tell you that certain locations, certain growers' neighbors are the typical suspects. There's a wide variation in the use of a chemical safely and disasters. My personal opinion would be is those, a majority of the problems we have are people we just need to bring into the fold to look out for pollinator protection. So the bottom line of what I have to say today is, whose job is it to bring about understanding about issues surrounding pollinators and pesticides? It's our job. And we're doing a really poor job of it if all we want to do is sit around and sing to the choir. Can we start extending our hand to others in our agricultural community who would really like to be a part of saving bees and who have a potential of making huge impact? Saving the bees is a very popular idea that everyone wants to be a part of since the news of colony collapse disorder. What are we doing to help the general public? Farmers and growers do their part. We must begin our dialogue in a reasonable, fair manner. And anyone pushing for a ban on a specific chemical should have a working knowledge of a proven and acceptable substitution. And nothing is not an acceptable solution. Every time a chemical is removed from the market, growers and beekeepers have to scramble and learn the ropes of new and sometimes unknown products. Will the new product prove to be more detrimental to the pollinators? Unfortunately, we cannot ban thrips or spider mites or aphids or bean beetles or fruit flies. If we want edible food on our table, pests and diseases in our crops must be mitigated. And I can give you one example of that, and that's Thionex, or endosulfan, I think it is. This is a product that we've been using in our seed crop for years, and beekeepers and growers have really gotten good at working together, timing in and out and around that spray. It's going out. The last uses of it go out this year, and I'm meeting with my growers on an ongoing basis this winter here. And we're going to be talking about what's the new product? What is it going to require? We're going to have to retrain ourselves. I hope it's a good product. There is a better way to move forward, and here is a great icebreaker, and I know that this pesticide book from OSU was handed out. This is a great icebreaker between parties, whether it's beekeepers and growers or who. I'm in the process of meeting with all my growers and giving them a copy. It is loaded with great reading, but the power is in the arrays of the chemical information. I like to sit down with them and go through the book, take a look at some chemicals, and then I give them the book. But again, I'm not sitting there telling them how to farm any more than my neighbors are calling me and asking me if they can spray their Christmas trees. What's happening here is we're working together as it should be in agriculture. So here's my three proposals. Every year across the state, there are mandatory refresher courses for licensed and private chemical applicators. How about if we make sure that at least one session is about pollinator protection, offering simple, workable solutions to avoiding bee kills? Last year, I was invited to a chemical applicator retraining class at OSU at LaSalle, which is a huge auditorium. It was packed with licensed applicators. A week after that, I got my scorecard. Out of 40 speakers, I took third place. I felt, and it's not that I'm that great of a speaker, I'm not, I felt that just the reaction we got from the audience, they were very invited by the fact that the beekeeper and the applicator could work together. The entire presentation was an invitation to work together on things. Number two, how about if every single commercial and otherwise licensed pesticide applicator be given an introduction to this awesome manual from OSU? This manual was printed. Copies have gone out to certain parties, and now it's sitting on the shelf. This is a powerful, it's a wonderful book, great coffee table book, but a reference. Once you learn to use the thing, you go all the way to the back, take the chemical name. You cross-reference to the trade name, you go to the middle, it gives you all the precautions. It's great. And number three, lastly, everyone wants to save the bees these days. Can we help them do that? Can we give them simple, comfortable and workable solutions that allow us all to be winners and feed the millions of hungry? A good first step is the mutual recognition and understanding that we're all working very hard and trying to make a living at the same time. Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives, fellow agricultural professionals.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I wanted to first extend a genuine thank you and appreciation to the Honorable and Distinguished Committee for allowing me and others to talk about the important issue of bees and pesticide use. My name is Alan Taransky, Vice President of Glory Bee. And my father, Dick Taransky, started Glory Bee in 1975 as a commercial beekeeper, honey processor, and beekeeping supply outfit. I've had numerous experiences with bees growing up and had the opportunity to teach beekeeping classes, and bees have captured my fascination from the age of 10, harvesting bumper crop of 160 pounds of honey for my first hive in Lane County. Today, Glory Bee employs 177 Oregonians, and we provide the Pacific Northwest with high-quality natural ingredients, beekeeping supplies, honey, and more. I'm going to share with you a little bit about, from a business perspective, why bees are so important to our economy here in the state of Oregon. As we've heard, bees are responsible for pollinating a third of the world's food and arguably some of the healthiest food we can eat. Across Oregon, as we've heard, over $650 million worth of agricultural crops each year rely on honeybee pollination. From Columbia to Polk to Clackamas to Washington to Klamath and Yamhill County, virtually every inch of the state of Oregon benefits from the pollination of bees. If you've ever enjoyed an Oregon apple or pear or marionberry or raspberry or blueberry, you've enjoyed something that's been pollinated by bees. At Glory Bee, about a third of the products that we sell are reliant on the honeybee. Thank you, Mr. Vanderpool, for being a beekeeper here in the state of Oregon. And he's one of many great beekeepers we have. Another one who I had the pleasure to converse with this morning, George Hansen of Foothills Pollination and Honey, employs 8 people, runs 5,000 colonies that pollinate crops starting in the almonds and into Oregon. Those bees visit 5 different crops, each hive, each year. Over the past decade, the cost to maintain each hive has doubled to $200 per hive annually. Increased pesticide and fungicide use do have negative effects when there's not collaboration between beekeepers and farmers. Pesticides have always been a problem. We've heard that today. My dad started beekeeping in 1975 and ran into numerous instances where there was misproperly applied pesticides and his hives died. Pesticides don't discriminate, and we need to understand that. They kill both important and beneficial insects as well as the targeted insects. Honeybees have been dying by the tens of millions due to colony collapse disorder, a phenomenon linked to the dramatic rise and disappearances in colonies. Although no specific cause has been identified, clearly pesticides can be a part of the problem. There's estimates that CCD has wiped out over 10 million beehives over the past 6 years. Compared to 1947, when we had 6 million hives, today we have 2.5 million hives in our country. If we don't fix the underlying issues of pesticides and CCD, yields will go down without bees and will be relegated to things like hand pollination. And as you can imagine, the cost to buy an apple or a pear would be extremely higher than it would be to fix the problem that we're facing with honeybee decline. Bee health is extremely important to Glory Bee as a business and as a passion. With such a large percentage of our products here in the state of Oregon reliant on the honeybee, we've launched our own program. We've partnered with the OSU Honey Bee Lab at Oregon State and Dr. Ramesh Sagili. This is important to secure our own future as a company here in the state of Oregon. How do we move forward? I believe, as Mr. Vanderpool spoke, communication and collaboration is key between farmers, beekeepers, pesticide applicators, and researchers. An example of good communication occurred this last year in Central Oregon, where the carrot seed farmers rely heavily on honeybees to pollinate their seed crops. And they sprayed those crops with a pesticide to eliminate and exterminate various sucking pests. What they didn't know is that that also, because the insecticide label was not clear, that also could harm the bees, and the bees stopped feeding. And the bees stop feeding, they die. Commercial beekeepers working with Central Oregon Seed contacted Dr. Ramesh Sagili at the Oregon State Honeybee Lab, and through immediate research, he determined that the sprayed crops were the cause of bee deaths, and the growers, heavily dependent on the bees for successful yield, implemented a new schedule, sending the bees home a week early before spraying to prevent further deaths. It's a great example by working together and being educated that growers, beekeepers, and researchers were able to pinpoint root cause problems and implement a solution. This model should be encouraged to repeated statewide. In closing, bees are just as important to Oregon agriculture as the water and the sun, and we need to understand that. Again, they contribute to over $650 million in crops each year, plus indirect effects on other businesses, which is making that number even higher. CCD and pesticide use will not only harm farmers, but cause food prices to skyrocket. Our job is to work together, growers, beekeepers, and researchers, to combat the issue. In closing, my father and I have seen firsthand and heard numerous accounts through talking with beekeepers every year of the devastation that pesticides can cause. And with bees contributing to such a large portion of our economy, we need to do something to preserve these amazing pollinators. I'm not sure the exact way forward, but thankful to Chair Witt, Vice Chair Frederick, and the entire committee for taking the time to discuss this important issue. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Do the members have questions or comments? Gentlemen, I'm not seeing any. I want to thank you very much for your testimony, and I want to thank you both very much for the business that you conduct here in the state of Oregon. I appreciate very much your dedication to the jobs that you do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to shift gears and move towards informational hearing on the Aggie Bond Program. You may remember that as the former House Bill 2700. I'm going to call up, please, John Saris and Ivan Molesky.
Keep me awake.
And Stephanie Page? Good afternoon. Welcome to our committee. I'm going to apologize in advance. I have to step out for a moment, but Representative Thompson will be chairing the meeting. Thank you.
I will be kind. Please proceed whatever order you want.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris. I'm the Business Services Manager at the Oregon Business Development Department. As you're aware, and I've just had a couple brief comments for the committee, and then we'll happily answer some questions. Business Oregon was tasked with implementing and establishing House Bill 2700, the Aggie Bond Program. And as we talked about earlier in the year, the plan that we were pursuing is to basically outsource the development of the program with a consulting firm. As we've kind of worked through the process, the agency has identified a consultant that's actually been under contract at this point and will be producing some deliverables for us in December. Basically, those deliverables are, in essence, going to establish really the framework for the program. We're going to have a draft of the administrative rules, procedures, policies, best practices from the 8 states currently using the program. They'll develop the draft application or a draft of the application. The consultant will work with the Department of Justice and Bond Council to establish the framework and mechanics for Business Oregon to issue the Aggie bonds, including issues related to bond volume cap, issuing authority, and determinations of eligibility and prerequisites for commission action. The
consultant will also develop recommendations consistent with Oregon State Treasury rules and cost effectiveness for who may serve as the agency's bond counsel. The department does have some experience working with establishing and implementing new programs that are basically based off of the Internal Revenue Code. The legislature passed the Oregon New Market Tax Credit program in 2011, and kind of looking at the framework and how that program was established and developed, it took about a year to get that program up and running. We basically estimated that the program would take about 9 months, and we're on track for that. With the deliverables that we get back from our consultant here in mid-December, we've got about 2 weeks to turn around department comments, get some feedback from some of the groups that we're working with, and then get a final product back from the consultant just before the 1st of February. We've been working very closely, as you're aware. Our agency works very closely with the lenders and the lending community. We've been in contact with the Oregon Bankers Association, some of the ag lenders across the state, and you know, basically had an opportunity to talk about this program and how they may be able to use it for some of their clients in the future. So with that, really, as I mentioned, the program's really on track to be launched, if you will, the 1st of April. You know, we'll be happy to answer any questions as they come up.
We'll have all of your testimony and then open it for questions, if that's okay.
Chair Thompson, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky, Friends of Family Farmers, based in Molalla, Oregon. We are very excited this program's moving forward. Business Oregon's been doing a good job getting the ball rolling on bringing on consultants, and as was mentioned, likely to be seeking public comment in the not-too-distant future. We've had the opportunity to talk with both Business Oregon and the Oregon Department of Agriculture about rolling this program out and how to promote it. So, you know, we've actually received calls in our office of folks inquiring to see if they would be eligible, what the timing is. So we think there's going to be a great deal of interest in the program once it's up and running. And just a brief reminder of what problem this program is intended to address and who it's hoping to assist. According to the most recent census of agriculture back in 2007, the average age of Oregon farmers is approaching 58 years old. It's likely in this upcoming census to be older than that. According to the Oregon Department of Agriculture, some 50% of Oregon's farmland is going to change hands over the next decade. So there's a real issue with an aging farm population and changing hands of agricultural land. And you know, issues of the price of land and the price of equipment and other inputs are always rising. I was running some numbers. According to the Council of Development Finance Agencies, which tracks Agibonds programs around the country, there's an average interest rate savings for folks who are able to take advantage of this program of between 1% and 3%. Just penciling out, I looked at an amortization calculator. If you were to get a $450,000 farm loan for a 25-year term, at today's rates for a farm loan, you're looking at about 7.5%. If you could get that knocked down to about 5.5% through the Agibonds program, you could literally be saving over $550 a month, about $6,700 a year, and over $168,000 over the life of that loan. If you were able to get it knocked down to 4.5%, you're looking at you know, over $800 of savings per month, close to $10,000 per year, and literally $250,000 savings over the life of that loan. So this is a really significant program. It is tiered to the IRS code and the definitions of first-time farmer. That means folks who do not currently own land, or if they do own land, if they own land that's less than 30% of the median county or median farm size for that particular county. So it's not necessarily going to apply to everyone, but it is really meant to look at folks who are. It could be a farmer, frankly, who's been leasing land for some time, very experienced, but to the IRS, they're technically a first-time farmer. So if you look at some of the other states around the country, there's a variety of numbers of these loans issued annually. Pennsylvania does about 18 a year, Colorado 8 per year, South Dakota is in that range as well, and Missouri about 10 to 12. So we're hopeful Oregon can kind of meet or exceed those sorts of numbers, and we are committed as an organization to really promoting this program once it's up and running. Thank you.
Thank you, members of the committee. For the record, Stephanie Page with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I don't have a lot to add to what John and Ivan already said, other than we look forward to working with them to get the word out about the program. Friends of Family Farmers, Farm Bureau, and other organizations have very well-established networks of members, and I think that will be an excellent way to get the word out about the program. I've received a couple of calls from farmers who are interested in helping their children or grandchildren acquire farmland, and they were interested in the program. So other than that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the concerns that we had when we were setting up this program was the cost per loan. I think that was maybe one of the biggest debates that we had throughout the course of the year on this bill. Do you have an update about what we expect the cost per loan to be? Is it coming under projection? Is it going to be affordable for us to do as a program long term?
Chair, Representative Unger, members of the committee, we don't have updates on what the actual costs are going to be. That's part of the proposal that the consultant's going to be putting together. There are fixed factors. Treasury has issuance costs. The biggest variable out there is going to be bond counsel and the costs associated with bond counsel. The state's fee for issuance is probably going to be very consistent with most other states, 1.5%, something along those lines. So then, of course, you're going to have lender's fees. So I think what we're trying to do is determine what the most cost-effective manner to issue these is going to be that's compliant with the state treasurer's rules for issuance and bond counsel.
Yes, please.
Are any of these loans available for unimproved land or land with no buildings on it already? I was reading something in the Wall Street Journal about some farm loans that are being made available in parts of Montana that are on unimproved land, and they're borrowing, like the example they gave was a $1 million loan on an unimproved 1,100 acre parcel that was sagebrush. And I was just wondering, you know, what are the, do you have size limitations? Is it unimproved? Is it improved? Whatever.
Chair, members of the committee, that's a great question. This gets back to what is an eligible project according to IRS tax code. I'm not an expert on the program. My belief would be that unimproved land would probably be an eligible cost along with equipment and other fixed assets. So as far as the limitations associated with the program, by the tax code, I believe the current limit is somewhere around $516,000 in this tax year would be the maximum issuance size for a project that's eligible. The actual what is being financed is going to be up to the lender to determine whether or not something they want to finance, and then up to bond counsel to determine whether that's an eligible cost or not.
And Representative Witt said, I may add to that just briefly that it really is, if the lender is willing to lend on it as an agricultural property, I think that's going to be a decisive factor. And so Northwest Farm Credit Services or another lender is going to be looking at those kinds of questions. In addition to the more than $500,000 at the IRS level, the Farm Service Agency can often nearly match that. So you may actually be able to look at something on the order of $1 million in terms of the cost of a property.
So I have a follow-up then. So does the federal government guarantee these loans to the banks then? If the banks decide to do this after you've gone through the process, does the federal government back up these loans and repay the banks if the people can't come through? I mean, I question a $1 million loan on 1,100 acres of sagebrush in an arid area in another state, but I'm want to know if the banks are going to be careful, or if they're just going to go, oh, federal government's going to pay if it doesn't all work out.
The chair, members of the committee, the lenders are going to apply prudent underwriting when they're evaluating these loans. There is not a guarantee. There is not a liability associated with these bonds by the state of Oregon. These are what are called conduit bonds. So all the state is really doing in these particular bonds is determining that the interest income associated with this meets the eligibility to be not taxed to the lender. And so it's not actually a financing program. It's an eligibility for an income tax abatement on the interest income. There may be some guarantees on the underlying debt associated with it, but typically there are prohibitions from what's called double dipping with federal funds. So typically if you have tax-exempt financing, it's not eligible, say, for an SBA or USDA or Farm Service guarantee associated with that. But once again, that'll be a bond council question.
Representative Unger.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Just one other question back to kind of how the whole program is working. I know when we were discussing this bill back in the spring, Ivan, you had a lot of suggestions and had experts around people who could provide affordable bond counsel. Are you finding that those suggestions are being well taken by the current consultant? And do you have confidence that we're going to set up a good program here that's going to be affordable for people? Or do we need to do anything to help make sure that that happens?
Well, Chair Witt, Representative Unger, it appears to us that Business Oregon's really cast a wide net to try to find the right consultants. We're encouraged by the fact they're looking at other states that have these programs set up so that we can identify best practices, perhaps, you know, template documents that may work. They also have to do due diligence with the state of Oregon's requirements. So, you know, we're just eager to get it up and running. They appear to be doing a pretty darn good job at this point in time.
That's great.
Yes, Representative Thompson.
I have an overwhelmingly agricultural district, and I'm extremely interested in this project and hopeful. I have a lot of underutilized farmland, and I have a large number of young farmers with moths in their pockets, and I'm hoping this may be an avenue we can jumpstart part of the rural economy by getting the two together. And I'd also remind you, when you get to that point, it'd be a good idea to notify the legislature, because we have a lot of constituent outreach avenues that could feed directly into people who'd be interested in these projects. But we don't have a lot going for the agricultural community right now, and I really can't overemphasize how important this might be for the next step. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything additional for the panel? Thank you all very, very much. Appreciate your testimony. With that, we're going to shift gears again to the coastal multi-species CMP, and I'd like to call forward, please, Ed Bowles.
Positive?
No, not really. Whatever you think, it won't work. It'll cost money. Jeez. So let's do it anyway, and then later, okay, it's not so bad, I guess. Of course, it's a disaster. I told you so.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Chair Witt, and members of the committee. My name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator, and pleased to be here to hopefully briefly touch base on the coastal plan. You'll notice it's got a nice bureaucratic long name. We'll just refer to this as the coastal plan from here on out. And I want to just start briefly by letting you know that we've been going about completing these coastal, we call them conservation plans, over the course of the last decade, and we are just about done with all the sea run salmon and steelhead populations throughout the state. A lot of those which are listed in the Lower Columbia, Willamette, and further up the Columbia and Snake. So this coastal plan that we're going to talk about is the last, one of the last pieces to that. Most of these other plans are completed, adopted by our commission, and already being implemented throughout the state. A lot of them in partnership with not only different state agencies and the public, but also our federal partners, because many of these other ones are listed. So for this particular plan, we've got some unique situations, and it's sort of sets this up as, I think, a very exciting opportunity for us. First off, this is pretty ambitious. It's actually six species groups But the beauty of it is that none of them are listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act. So we have more flexibility and more power within the state family to get it right, so to speak. This represents all the watersheds north of Cape Blanco, up to our border, and it that drain into the coast. And it, the way we go about this is we establish a conservation platform that makes sure these fish are able to sustain themselves into the future. And then on that platform for this plan, we're going to be looking at new or modified opportunities to make fishing even better, and also to try to provide better conservation, more secure conservation for these fish into the future. Now, we've had kind of a two-pronged public approach to doing this. We've used four stakeholder teams to help us shape the first draft, and those have been distributed up and down the coast for each of these groupings of populations. And that's, those stakeholder teams have actually helped us get to the point of being able to prepare a public draft that'll be going out early next year. And then we begin a kind of more focused general public outreach, which will include a series of town hall meetings up and down the coast. And that'll be through this winter. And then, if all goes according to plan, we hope to have this in front of our commission for potential adoption this spring. So I talked a little bit about the process timeline. Really, we did a lot of technical work on the front end. This has been a couple years in the making, but I want to call your attention, and you'll remember this, last June, there was a legislative hearing. I think it was this committee. One of my colleagues, Bruce McIntosh, was here to present on that. And at that point in time, I believe there was quite a bit of public concern about this plan, much of it substantive concern, some of it just confusion about what was going on, but a general feeling that things were moving too fast and perhaps we were being too ambitious on our efforts to try to improve fishing but also improve conservation, kind of cake and eat it too. As a result of that hearing, you'll notice on this timeline in June, we took what I'd call a bit of a timeout or a pause and refocused on some sessions to really try to hear more of what was going on in the coast, what were the concerns, and then we had some focus work groups that I'll talk about in a minute that allowed us to kind of revisit some of what was moving forward. And we have now completed that sort of reconnecting, hopefully, with most of the public concerns. Now, through the stakeholder teams, and now we're ready to move forward with a draft to the public, as I mentioned. And I want to talk a little bit more about the kind of stakeholder listening sessions and work sessions that we had. And there were, this was following that June legislative hearing. We had one in Tillamook and one in Reedsport in late June, early July, following that hearing. And then we followed that up, and this is actually at request of the stakeholder teams. They really felt they had a chance to get to consensus, and they really wanted to be given the opportunity before we went to a public draft to get to consensus on the key elements. And so we went back to them again in September and October with a meeting in Newport and another one in Coos Bay with these stakeholder teams. And I should mention, these stakeholder teams represent a diverse interests of the different fisheries, but also land-based interests, as well as conservation interests and the fishing interest. So, long story short, we had these four groups coming together through these meetings, and we're actually able to get consensus. And so the outcome of that is there was some substantive negotiation on what stayed in and what was pulled out of the plans. And there is fewer proposed changes from the status quo than what was originally anticipated. But we believe, as the fish managers and the scientists, that this plan, as currently ready to move forward, still provides conservation benefits. So it still moves us forward from a conservation standpoint. And we also believe that it still provides substantive improvements in fishing on the coast, which is our kind of goal for this, is to improve both of those fronts. We also received strong message, and we're able to build in a stronger integration with the Oregon Hatchery Research Center to try to learn as we go moving forward, both with research and monitoring. And as I mentioned before, we were able to reach consensus with the stakeholder teams on the key elements of the plan now, which we did not have before. So I'm just going to touch on some of the key elements of the plan, and then if any of you want follow-up on the details as we head into the public comment side of this through the winter, I'd be happy to meet with any of you individually. But basically, I want to reiterate, the fish on the coast are predominantly doing okay. All right. We have no conservation crisis right now. There are some areas of concern and a few populations where we are having to do something to get them from, I'll call it a red or a yellow light to a green light. But we also have no fishery crisis. Many of you have hopefully been tracking the fishery this past year and hopefully participated in it. It's been remarkable. The fishing opportunities on the coast this past year for salmon and steelhead in our watersheds. So because of that, the majority of the actions do remain status quo. Now, that doesn't mean we underperform. That just means if it isn't broken, don't fix it, okay? But there is still opportunity to improve fishing and conservation, and that's been where we've been focusing our efforts with the stakeholder teams. So there have been some hatchery consolidations, and there's also been some new and enhanced hatchery programs. We've included the ability to manage harvest on more of a sliding scale than just a one-size-fits-all. So this allows you to kind of, from a harvest standpoint, make hay when the sun is shining, when you've got abundant runs, increasing the daily and seasonal bag limits. And then when things get really tight, you can tighten the belt and be a little more conservative, but not get into a situation where you're actually shutting down fisheries like we had in 2008, on the North Coast, for example, in the Nehalem, which is a place we don't want to ever go to again if we can avoid that. That had definite economic ramifications. We also are pushing forward as aggressively as we believe we can on predator actions, including volunteer-based hazing, which is supported through some legislative help that we've gotten with that, particularly with Representative Krieger's interest on cormorants, but also on pinnipeds moving forward, and looking for an actual depredation permits and getting those for some of the avian predators. Habitat recommendations will be coming through this, but the main focus of this plan is not to take on all the habitat issues, but to be complementary to the Oregon Plan forum that is dealing with habitat issues through the watershed councils and other things. And then we've got a couple new ideas that our stakeholder teams really were excited about us moving forward. One of those is mandatory tag returns. These are your harvest tags that you have with your license. Right now, those are not mandatory. And so that's something they'd really like to get better data on. And then a pilot program on requiring the guides to have logbooks. I mean, the pilot program would be a small group of those, and we'd like to see if that works, because we believe that we can get a lot of good data on the fishery and the fish from the guides. I'd like to talk just a little bit. Hatcheries are just a piece of this plan, but I know that that's where a lot of the concerns as well as the opportunity comes from. Let's face it, a lot of our fisheries are supported by these hatchery programs. So this is just an example of one of the elements of the plan. High level look at the hatchery piece.
And so if you'll take a look at this slide, there's the overall production of smolts from our hatcheries on the coast. We're recommending it goes up from 6 million currently to 6.3 million. We believe that is defensible from a conservation standpoint, and we believe that it will provide significant new opportunities for fisheries. We are, though, to complement that increase in overall production, we are going to be recommending, and it is supported through the stakeholder teams, a slight reduction in the number of locations stocked, and this is the consolidation piece for some of the hatchery programs. And so we've got a very slight reduction in the net. There's three areas that had hatchery programs that won't now, but two that never had hatchery programs that will. And so it's almost neutral there, but a slight loss. I talked about some of the consolidation where we're trying to get focused hatchery programs and where we're getting the most economic benefit out of those, and also having a portfolio that has some wild fish emphasis areas and some hatchery fish emphasis areas. And one of the things I'm most excited about is, those of you familiar with the coastal fisheries, one of the places economically for these coastal communities that we currently have a bit of a hole is in the springtime. The fall fisheries have been remarkable. Not too recent past, we had some downturn in ocean salmon opportunities. But without those ocean salmon opportunities, there's in some cases very little opportunity in the spring. Of course, Representative Krieger with the Rogue, and that has opportunity down there, but a lot of the coast doesn't have opportunity in the spring. We're looking at starting several new spring Chinook programs, Coos Bay, Yaquina Bay, and then the Little Nestucca River, and then ramping up some existing spring Chinook programs in the Tillamook and the Nestucca to try to fill in that current, what we believe is underutilized opportunity in the springtime. We believe this can be ecologically defensible and done in a good way and provide very good economics to the system. So that's, and these figures just kind of show you the kind of the context of where the hatchery fish are currently being released and where the changes are. As you'll notice, both on the top graph is the total smolts released, and the blue is current, and the kind of greenish yellow is the proposed, and then the locations released, and that shows the four strata and then the total. That's why I say the vast majority of what we're doing is, you'll notice, not a big changes. It's status quo. But those changes that are being made help us kind of lean into the conservation piece to ensure these species will be sustained in the future. But they also allow us, where we're adding new fisheries, new opportunity to improve fishing on the coast as well. Finding that balance has been the role of the stakeholder teams. They've taken that challenge very seriously. And I'm pleased that they were able to get to consensus. It took a lot of hard work, and I don't think anybody got exactly what they wanted, but they were able to find kind of those midpoints where everybody felt it was good compromises to get to a consensus vote. But the process is not done. Now, that was just to get to a public draft, which we now go through a series. We're probably going to have up to five or six town hall type meetings along the coast this winter, because these stakeholders, even though they're very well-meaning, they don't necessarily represent everybody in the public. And so we're going to try to tap into the rest of the public through these town hall meetings. And then we also did a opinion survey to help inform this for folks that don't ever show up to meetings, that just go fishing. And so we've also tapped into that. All of that will shape the final plan, which then will go to our commission probably March, April, somewhere in there, if we stay on track. Okay? So that's the update, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Who's first? All right, Representative Krieger, please.
Ed, when Bruce McIntosh was here, we asked him some questions about statute numbers and what they meant.
Oh, you very good.
And in talking to Kurt Melcher, Jim Myron, Joel Rohleder, Tom Wolf, they thought maybe you should be put through that same group.
Mr. Chair, it's a good thing the time is almost out for this
committee. I was kidding you there, but we had discussed, when I was at Charleston with you, the social programs where you shift, take hatchery fish out of one part of a system, South Fork of Coquille, and you put them somewhere else. We've already had some social problems there. Yeah. Fights, landowners not allowing boats to be launched, pressures to have no motors, that type of thing. What final type of discussion did you have regarding that part of the program?
Yes, and Chair Witt and Representative Krieger, I've been meaning to, and we haven't had a chance yet, and I don't know if we have time during these interim days, but it would be definitely worthwhile to come in and go through the details with you of where they landed on the final. But just in general, for the Coquille, there had been a plan for two of the areas to have the fish removed, the winter steelhead removed from two of the forks of the Coquille, put in the South Fork. Where the group landed was only one of those now has been consolidated, the other one staying with the winter steelhead hatchery program along with the South Fork, which was never going to be removed. And the one that is, if you're familiar with it, it's the East Fork Coquille, which has very little access.
Yeah.
So that'll be the one that'll be a, quote, wild fish emphasis area. And they felt that was a reasonable compromise. And so that other one was put back in. That was one of the ones that was restored, the hatchery fish back to the, so that not all those will be shifted over to the South Fork Coquille, which is a great fishery, but I think your concern was that it would get too crowded. Okay?
Doesn't Ed have what I call a real nice recreational experience when people are cussing at each other, throwing rocks, and overcrowding competition? A couple other things. Do you know if the department internally, whether it's been put out publicly yet or not, has had any consideration of reduction of bag limits on certain streams anywhere regarding anadromous fish, salmon, or steelhead?
Chair Witt and Representative Krieger, as I mentioned, part of the package that was rolled forward included harvest considerations. And what's changed there, and I don't know if this is what you're talking specific streams that would change, because across the board we're going from right now, which is we kind of do, it's 2 and 20 for the daily and seasonal for most of is the permanent reg, but then we've got regs on the North Coast that's 1 and 10 or 2 and 10 right now. And those are static. So what we're planning on now to avoid what happened, because of that downturn in the ocean in 2005, and we ended up closing the Halem to fishing totally, and we said we'd never want to go there again. We're doing a sliding scale approach, so you will have changes in the bag limit under the very low years, but you won't ever be shut down under this theory. And then the vast majority of years, you'll have a permanent bag limit, of which it will be, right now the proposal is 1 in 10 for the North Coast, and then 2 in 10 for the mid-coast and the south coast. All right. Now, that's just for wild fish. And then you can still get the remainder of that through the your hatchery fish, obviously as many as you want on the hatchery card. And then you can actually go, and this is probably more information than you wanted, but you can actually, if you're limited by your north coast one, those folks can still go to the mid-coast if they want to get their additional 10 wild fish to get to the 20. And that was part of what was important to the stakeholder teams, that they could all eventually get the full amount of the. And then what we haven't had in the past is when fishing, like this past year, we would consider that a good ocean condition year, good fish returning. You relax the bag limits daily and seasonally for some places, and you get to keep more, up to the 20 fish, wild fish per year.
Okay.
Okay.
Please.
You had mentioned going to mandatory tag return. We did that several years ago with big game. We have to call in. And I have not really heard what you experienced as far as the number of non-reporters. And then there was a $25 fee. Can you talk a little bit about what, or do you know what happened there? And do you think you're going to experience something similar here?
Chair Witt and Representative Krieger, you know, the mandatory program for the harvest tag, you know, for the big game, I think is going to play out a little differently than here. Our approach that we're desiring is to ease into this without a penalty out of the blocks and help folks understand how useful the data is, and then see if we need a penalty in order to get compliance, because we can tell compliance very easily, and before we would go to a penalty phase. But that is a similar approach that Wildlife took, and you'll have to probably talk to Kurt Melcher on the details of that. I know there's been some bumps and bruises, but it is moving forward. And anything like this transitionally is hard on the public if they're not used to it. But I know from our standpoint, everybody out there fishing is coding when they get the fish and where they got the fish, and for us not to have that data to help for fish management, to me, is a real loss, given that they're all actually doing this. The question is, how do we get them to get this to us? And we want to incentivize and help help them do it voluntarily before we go with a any sort of a penalized approach.
One more follow-up.
Sure, you're fine.
You had mentioned you're going to have winter meetings up and down the coast. Can you avoid that when we're in the legislative session so we will not be able to attend? That has happened in the past.
Sure, what, Representative Krieger, that's a good point. That may set us back a little. I think the plan now is to get them done in a real quick way the end of January, the last 2 weeks. Will that work out? I think you're not here till February, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, we are up here for legislative days for 3 days.
And we will avoid those 3 days.
And we also have committee chairs and vice chairs that do a little work here ahead of time.
Right now, we are planning on the draft being out either late, because of the holidays. We don't want to have folks required to review this during the holidays. So that we want to give people at least a couple weeks to review the draft, and then we'd have the public meetings the end of January, and then so that we can roll out for this. So I think it'll fit, and I'll definitely follow up personally with you, Representative, as well on some details. You didn't ask me about elk and sixes, so those are some of the details I'm sure you're interested in.
I do have a question here, the difference between game fish, food fish, and commercial fish, but I won't ask him that.
Okay. Representative Whitsitt.
Since I'm not as familiar as Representative Krieger about all this, could you discuss your returns this year for the six species as compared to the historical maximum? Just in general, are we close to a historical, not projected what it was before we were measuring, but like in the last 40 years or 30 years?
Representative Chair Witt and Representative Whitsitt, this figure I just threw in is in case for background. This gives you some idea of the actual wild spawners, so it's the kind of the fish returning. And the species are across the bottom, so coho on the left, fall chinook, then spring chinook, winter steelhead, and summer steelhead. So those are the codes. And this shows, and the earlier ones are by decade, so this actually goes back 70-some years or 60-some years. And so so this, for each group, left to right, it's 1950s through to the present time that we have data. And it kind of gives you a sense of how fish returns are going at that decadal scale. And then we've the blue on the right for each of these shows just the last 2 years. So in general, as you can see, coho are notoriously volatile in and of themselves, so don't read too much into that, but we are amazingly happy with our coho returns. And these are wild coho, and these are the only listed fish that we have on the coast. Surprise, surprise, yet they're doing quite well here. Fall Chinook, you'll notice that the wild spawners have been going up. So that's why, you know, we don't believe there's any conservation concern there. Spring Chinook, which is that next one, looks like it's in terrible shape. The bottom line is remember, this is north of the Rogue, okay? So it does touch the Umpqua, but spring Chinook are really fish that need a snowpack-driven system to really thrive, because they come in and hold during the summer, and our coastal streams that are rain-driven are too warm. And so you really have very few there to start with, but what we do have, we want to make sure we protect, and that's why we do have some protections in here. You brought up about the bag, Representative Krieger, on the Umpqua. We are talking about reducing the bag on that spring component to try to protect that. And they are barely there, but we don't believe we can ever get them to the point where they're like these other species. Winter steelhead, you know, they bounce around, but they're pretty stable. And then summer steelhead are like spring Chinook. They really, without snowpack-driven system, really aren't all that common on the coast. So this gives you a picture of kind of what's going on. And I do have, but we won't, this shows kind of the hatchery releases as well, if you are interested in that. So.
I would just comment that perhaps it's unknown factors that are driving this oceanic conditions. I don't see that we've had time to recover through terrestrial conservation measures, recoveries like that, that you see. Would you agree? I mean, that we really don't understand why we have these massive returns some years. It can't be something that small of a time period to improve the terrestrial conditions to have a return of your coho like that. Just a comment.
Chair Witt and Representative Whitsitt, I'd be very presumptuous if I claimed all of that was due to the Oregon plan.
Okay. All right.
But so ocean is a very big driver, but coupled with that, we have done a couple things management-wise. We don't know cause and effect, as you indicate, but we've reduced dramatically our hatchery program on coho. And we've improved habitats, but as you're well aware, it takes sometimes decades for habitats to heal. So this, to me, represents showing the ability of some of these species to really thrive when they're given enough good conditions, particularly in the ocean. But we are doing our part as managers to help make sure that they have good homes to come home to. And we are now, because of that reduction in hatchery programs, we are now opening up, in spite of their ESA listing, I think it's 12 or 13 watersheds now on the coast that we allow wild targeted harvest of these fish authorized by the federal government, and those are remarkable fisheries that our coastal communities really enjoy. And they're very limited, they're very cautious, but they really generate a buzz on the coast up and down all the way north to south.
Very good. Ed, a couple of items here. I'm pleased to hear that you're going to try and rely on voluntary information off of tags. But I think, frankly, there are some things that our state could do, and this doesn't necessarily isn't exclusive to the fishery side. I mean, I think on the game side as well. I would truly like to see the department explore some opportunities for positive reinforcement. And rather than penalties, you know, on the game side, it may be easier. I think, you know, there's room maybe to consider a preference point or something for after X number of years of reporting, you get a preference point or something. But I just think that's a lot better way to go than punishing people that angers them and may actually be driving them away from the sport and the participation in hunting and fishing in this state. So just a suggestion. And I also read some of the comments from the IMST folks. Mm-hmm. On the coastal CMP, and one of the things that they pointed to, it was almost like they're suggesting that we should take a look at whether it would be wise to shift from you only get to keep fin clip fish to you take the first fish that you catch. If it's fin clipped, maybe you get to keep on fishing. If it's a wild fish, you're done for the day. And it would help to eliminate hook-killed fish. And their suggestion is there may be a possibility that we would end up positively impacting our wild fish population by doing it that way. And I'm wondering if you or anyone else at the department has considered that and whether there's merit perhaps in some pilot program someplace in the state.
Chair Wedd, on your first point, you take it to heart that you're saying incentivize how we get our information rather than penalize.
Yes.
And I get that, and we will try our very best to move that direction on the fish side of things. Regarding the fishing aspects in the ocean, where we have fairly high mortality rates of cotton released fish, mm-hmm. particularly coho, we believe there is some merit, and we've moved towards a couple fisheries that we've allowed where it's not mark selective. You just take the first fish the fish you get. And our public is very pleased with those because they hate sorting through fish, particularly if they think those fish they release are going to die anyway. In freshwater, our handle mortality is much lower. And so if we have wild fish limits, you'll end up shutting down opportunity much quicker if you don't allow them to get at those hatchery fish, if they have to stop fishing. And so that's the trade-off, is the problem with we're using these hatcheries to provide fish for fishing. We want to, other than what we need for broodstock, we want every one of those caught. And so we want to make sure we're opened up as much opportunity as possible for them to do that. And so we wouldn't want to have anything in place that would keep them from being able to get at those hatchery fish. And so that's the trade-off on that. But in the ocean, we are actually already doing some limited non-mark selective fisheries because of the coho handle mortality.
Very good. Any additional questions or comments? Ed, thanks very much. Appreciate that. Next, we're going to switch to a report on the boat check law. And for those of you who showed up today for pinnipeds, I hate to disappoint you, but we're going to carry that over to our January meeting so that we'll have enough time, or we won't run out of time, I guess, for the testimony. So my apologies to anyone who showed up exclusively for that item. Okay. So next, I'd like to call up, please, Glenn Dolphin and Rick Boatner, please. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. I'll go first today. Good afternoon, Chair Witt and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Dolphin. I'm the Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator for the Oregon Marine Board. Just
briefly, I'm going to give an introduction and then just a couple highlights from 2013 activities and then turn it over to Rick. In 2009, the Oregon Legislature created the Aquatic Invasive Species Prevention Program, assigned authority to the Oregon Marine Board and Fish and Wildlife Department to oversee it. During 2013, as the Marine Board is the designated agency overseeing the boat permit program, we manage the revenues collected from that effort. Revenue source by statute, it's placed into a dedicated fund within the Marine Board budget, and we oversee those expenditures. The handout that I've given in shows the different boat categories that require permit fee for the different amounts. The Marine Board, we have in place numerous financial agreements, interagency agreements with our program partners to complete the work for the program. Primary partners in the program include Oregon Fish and Wildlife Department, our county sheriff departments, our Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. Portland State University is doing research and monitoring water bodies for zebra and quagga mussels. We also have an agreement with the U.S. Forest Service, who's coordinating coastal dives for marine invasive species surveys. On the submitted informational sheet, you can see the last 2 years of revenue fiscal amounts. Our on-water permit compliance efforts done by our partners, our law enforcement partners, are showing variable compliance around the state with the permit. Some counties report upwards of 90% compliance on permit requirements, while other areas are reporting somewhere around 60 to 70% compliance. With regards to enforcement, in 2013, we held 15 enforcement days at the highway boat check stations with enforcement agencies, where the compliance rate for stopping, as Rick will get into as well, is somewhere right around 70% compliance with stopping. During those 15 enforcement days, 30 citations were issued for non-compliance with stopping. This year, the state Marine Board and Fish and Wildlife Department, we completed a zebra and quagga mussel rapid response plan. This was finalized and outlines some specific steps that we'll take to respond to an incident where mussels are detected. We had a mock exercise to go through the plan this past April at Primeville Reservoir in Central Oregon. Obviously, we hope we don't have to implement this plan, but we are ready if we need to. So we are doing pre-planning to make sure for any future incidents. Regarding some outreach for the program, this continues to be a high priority for all of our program partners that I mentioned earlier. In addition, our law enforcement partners really are on the forefront of this program, interacting with the public on a daily basis. We have documented on-water contacts by law enforcement at 45,900 boaters this past year on the water. All those boaters are distributed information on the Aquatic Invasive Species Program. New this year, we developed a new sign for non-motorized boater access points, kind of smaller, undeveloped areas on our rivers and waterways. We distributed 500 of those signs statewide for posting. Previous to that, we've been focused on the bigger boating access sites with the motorized boat, and we have signage on those facilities as well. Between the Marine Board and Fish and Wildlife this year, we continued with press releases out. We did 5 press releases this year that produced 16 additional articles written in 11 different newspapers around the state that we were able to document. Additionally, radio and TV interviews were done this year, resulting in outreach in that media and numerous internet articles and different forums that are on the internet for fishing and others. Just finally, on my part of the update as well, the Marine Board, along with Coos County Parks Department, U.S. Forest Service, and the 10 Mile Lakes Basin Partnership, completed the construction of Oregon's first official boat wash station. It's targeting the cleaning of boats of aquatic invasives at that facility. It is located on the central coast in Coos County, city of Lakeside, at the Coos County Boat Access Point on 10 Mile Lake. We held a dedication ceremony in October for that facility and had great response from local elected officials. Representative McEwen also attended that event, and things are going really well. Locally, we hear that the boat wash station is being used quite frequently by boaters in that area. With that, thank you for the opportunity today and answer any questions or wait till the end.
We'll wait. Thank you very much.
Okay. It's just come on by itself for...
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Rick Boatner, the invasive species coordinator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We run the inspection program, and before you, I submitted a report of the summary of all our efforts since 2010 season, which when this program was created in 2009 legislation, so you have 2010, 2011, and then late 2011, House Bill 3399 was passed that gave us mandatory inspection, and it shows this is our second complete season of the mandatory stopping authority. And from the first two seasons, we had a 23% compliance rate with people stopping on a voluntary basis. Since the mandatory stopping authority, we've moved up to around 70% compliance rate. Our stations, and with the in the last four seasons, we have changed our strategy. The original 2 years, we was more outreach and education opportunities rather than inspections. And with the introduction of the mandatory stopping authority, we moved everything to the borders for preventative measures, so we're more into inspections. This year, the Central Point team, it's actually located at Ashland Port of Entry. They are generate about 63% of our inspection. We actually opened that inspection station in February. Then Ontario, Lakeview, and Klamath Falls, we opened in May. And then with the new biennium in July, we added additional four positions to the program. So we opened a check station in Gold Beach, Brookings area, and added another team to the Ashland station. So Ashland station was open 7 days a week compared to the other two. You'll notice total for all teams, we did about 7,400 inspections. Mm-hmm. We stopped 17 vessels or intercepted 17 vessels with quagga and zebra mussels on them or standing water with suspected villagers or quagga and zebra mussels. The rest of them are mostly other aquatic invasive species like Eurasian milfoil, barnacles, New Zealand mud snail, and those things. Even though Ontario was our second busiest station, that actually intercepted the most boats. It intercepted 13 boats coming into Oregon at there. Central Point was our top one for intercepting boats with plant material on it, and that was due to a lot to Emigrant Lake, Hyatt Lake. We had low water years, so there's a lot of weeds visible. During the inspections, if I can get this to advance. That's the wrong one. In the future, we did discover we got a couple of holes we'd like to fill. One would be on Highway 95 in Basque,
yep.
And the other one is on O'Brien. Is that cut off that goes up towards Grants Pass? Hmm. So those are holes we'd like to fill in the future. But this season, we inspected vessels from 42 different states. And the ones in the purple there, those are all states that have infestations of quagga zebra mussels or both. The yellow are the states that have no quagga and zebra mussels on it. You can see the Northwest is pretty much the last standhold to keep quagga and zebra mussels out. And Oregon, as well as Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming have pretty strong programs here. This is what our inspection stations kind of look like. The one at the top there, top right, that's our Ashland Port of Entry. We added the house or the construction trailer due to we start in February, so it's a little warmer for them, and they're actually there for 9 months. The other ones are our typical ones, the ones located at the Lakeview, which if you've been through the Lakeview exit, that's we're right there where the sign says, Welcome to Oregon. So they're the first things they see.
The bottom left-hand corner is actually the first boat we caught this season at the Ontario check station. This year, we found vessels that had mussels on them. Seven out of them Lake Powell, which just became infested this year. Lake Pleasant, Lake Mead are the more common ones. Lahontan Reservoir down in Nevada. Lake Erie, a couple, and a couple out of Utah. A total of 17 vessels. And the one thing we did find, we actually had a vessel that was previously decontaminated in another state, and when we actually deconned it, we found five live mussels still on it.
Wow.
So that was kind of eye-opening. This is what we're looking for in our inspection stations. You may not see it, but all around the, right by that little crevice, those are zebra or quagga mussels on it. So we're looking for very small creatures to keep out of the state. Generally, a person driving into Oregon, like I said, our inspection stations are at the borders. They'll see this boat inspection ahead first, and that's set up at a half a mile ahead by ODOT standards. Then you see inspection required for all watercraft, and then it moves forth on down until you come to the check station. So, with that, this is a picture of Lake Mead. Lake Mead, you can see down 50 to 70 feet down in the water, which, when the picture was taken, you should only have been seeing 2 or 3 feet due to the high levels of nutrients in the water. And these quagga and zebra mussels remove all that. This could happen to Oregon if they get in here. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you both very, very much. Representative Whitson.
I just have a comment. Are you familiar, I just read this in our paper, that they're potentially going to ban scuba diving in Crater Lake because of the same mussels.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of Oregon, or is that a federal thing that they're looking at?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitson, I haven't heard that part. I know they've been talking about it for years just for other things, but currently there is a decontamination of scuba gear available, and that's being practiced through a lot of the agencies and others and spread out through the diving world for decontamination of units, so that may be something they could do, but I haven't heard that directly.
I saw that you had inspected a couple of boats from Lake Erie. How long do mussels live out of a water body?
Chair Witt, depending on temperature and humidity, they can live up to 30 days outside the water body. So this time of year, they could be at least a week to 2 weeks. Boats coming out of Lake Mead in the summer, maybe a few days.
Uh-huh.
But they can last a long time once they close up.
This is just an entirely scary proposition that we would ever introduce them to our state. I recognize you pointed out a couple of holes that you would like to plug. How confident are the two of you that we have a program? What's the efficacy of the program that we are currently undertaking? What's your level of confidence that we're going to be able to prevent the introduction of mussels into this state? Quagga, zebra, or any of the others?
I'll take that one. From the position, I'd like to say 100%. But in reality, eventually they may get here.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever measures we can take now to prevent them from getting here, the longer we can prevent them getting in here, it'll save us quite a bit of money in infrastructure that they destroy, and also give science an opportunity to come up with, if you will, the magic bullet that could kill them.
Mm-hmm.
So the longer we can hold them off, the better mm-hmm. chance that we have.
Okay.
And so far, we have not detected any quagga and zebra mussels in the state or in the states surrounding us, except for Nevada and Utah, but for the Northwest states. So it's not a good, I can't give you a good number.
I understand. Glenn?
Yeah, I'd follow up with that, Chair Witt, and say that I feel pretty confident to say that if we weren't doing what we've been doing for the last 4 years, and including our neighboring states that are also doing the same effort for about the same amount of time, I believe we'd already have the mussels in our water bodies. Where all the states that are doing this in the Northwest are intercepting boats every single summer heading to Northwest waters with live mussels, with standing water from contaminated sources. So There may be some holes. You know, we're not at 100%, but I think what we're doing is working so far. Obviously, we could do better. We're operating probably at capacity of our current revenue sources that we have, which is just recreational boaters. We don't have any other sources of funds for the effort. But I believe we are making a difference, and we have been able to hold them off so far.
Great. Very good. Yes.
What is the coincidence? What is the coincidence that one guy's name is Boatner and the other one's Dolphin? You guys change your names?
That was part
of the
job.
Work for the
Marine Corps. It was part of the job.
Yes, Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are basically relying on the ability for Montana and Wyoming and Washington to in Idaho to stop anything coming in via the northern route there. In other words, 84 coming in from the north. Is that basically what I'm seeing?
No, we have Vice Chair Frederick. We have a check station in Ontario, so we're covering the entry in on 84. Mm-hmm. We do have help with Idaho and Wyoming. And we all, the Northwest communicates to each other when boats are coming in. So
I'm thinking about the northern coming down Columbia River area.
Yeah, currently we're relying on Montana and Idaho to check. Washington does have somewhat of a checking program, but yes, we are relying on them. But Washington right now is a very low risk state, and most of the higher risk boats are coming in from the south or east.
I'm actually thinking more about folks who are tourists or coming through, I mean, coming in from Lake Erie, for crying out loud, that's a pretty good trip. And if you're coming in from Lake Erie, you're very likely coming across the northern route rather than coming up and through the south. So I just was curious about that.
Yeah, Highway 97.
Could I just follow up with that?
Please.
Chair Witt and Representative Frederick. Over the last several years, the last 4 years really, as this program has grown, the state of Oregon, with all the Northwest states, have a very strong cooperating effort going on. We communicate a lot with each other throughout the year with inspection information and laws. And recently, the provinces in Canada have started to become more informed on the issues. Mm-hmm. We have what's called a Columbia River 100th Meridian Initiative planning group. So that includes the whole Columbia River Basin, and Canada is included in those efforts. We hold meetings twice a year to coordinate together, and Canada has started to implement some new laws associated with aquatic invasive species transport in boats, and I believe they're starting to try and come up with an inspection program as well. So they're making progress on that northern front above the U.S. border.
Follow up, just one.
Please.
What sort of numbers are Idaho and Wyoming and Montana getting? Are they getting 17? I mean, what are the numbers that they're seeing at this particular point?
I haven't seen their numbers this year. Last year, Idaho runs about 20 to 21 check stations. I can't remember the total number of boats but they intercepted 60 or 70 boats on theirs. Montana, I think this year they're right around 14, 15 that they've intercepted. And again, I couldn't tell you how many boats of that that is out of, because they do many more than we do. I can get those figures for you.
Just curious, I'm trying to see if whether we're catching them. They're catching them early so that we're getting the last group.
In some cases on the 84 route, I think that is the case, that we might be catching the ones that get missed. But the other ones are all out of California, coming up through California on 95, I-5, or 101. And we, for a better term, we get the first crack at those.
Thank you.
Thank you both very, very much. Certainly appreciate the work that you're doing to keep our waterways free of invasive species that we have no idea what we'd get into, and hopefully
a real mess.
So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I am going to close the informational hearing. And committee members, I have a couple of items of information here. First off, We have to determine what our committee bills will be by, is it Tuesday, Beth?
Tuesday, yeah.
And at this point, and I don't want the public to read anything into this, because the last day, my experience is that everybody comes up with all these ideas that they haven't had for the last 3 or 4 months. But right now, you have all suggested, or some of you have suggested, education for water well inspectors. You've suggested funding for the research that would be necessary to convince the feds that we can manage cormorants here in this state. And thirdly, a repeat of the 2013 Sessions raccoon bill. Now, again, those are the three suggestions that you have made. There may be others that are out there. I need to know those if you've got something that you want to consider. I also need to know that if any of these are problems. So get those to me if you can before you leave the building tomorrow. Secondly, I have spoken to some of you offline about a proposal to take a listening tour in December in far eastern Oregon. To listen to what the ag and natural resources communities think we're doing well, what we're not doing at all, what we need to do differently, and perhaps some things that we shouldn't even be involved in. What is a listening tour? And it will begin in Hermiston, go out to the Vale, Ontario, down to Burns and over to Bend, with many stops in between. It will be, I don't know, probably 800 miles or so in a 4-day period. This is strictly voluntary. The costs of your lodging will be on your own office expenses, as will probably your transportation. But if you're interested, I would encourage any and all to please let me know if you're interested. It is planned for the week before Christmas, Monday, December 16th through Thursday, the 19th. And not always the best traveling conditions, and maybe a little bit inconvenient in terms of it's close to Christmas. But I can tell you that the folks in eastern Oregon are very excited that we would even consider going out to their communities to listen to them. And I think, quite frankly, to be something that anyone who can participate would thoroughly enjoy. So with that, is there anything else for the good of the order? Representative Reardon?
Just if anybody had thoughts based on what you heard at today's B testimony, I would love to hear it by noon tomorrow.
Okay. Very good. Anything else? Seeing none, hearing none, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, committee members, and thank you to the members of the public as well. Thank you to the members of the public as well.